Buddy Hans is occupied for a few minutes, so we'll get underway. And we're beginning with
questions. Good morning, everyone. Purpose of this session is to discuss the feedback that we received on the conceptual framework exposure draft and to give you the opportunity of to ask any questions or provide any comments that you might have on the agenda paper series 10, which we provided you with, which tends to summarise the main messages that we got out of the feedback on the exposure draft. This isn't a decision-making session. We're not going to ask you to make any decisions, but hopefully the information that you get from the papers and from the discussion today will provide you with some background to help you make some decisions at next month's meeting when we're going to ask you about the strategy for continuing the conceptual framework. So which areas we should be focusing on, where we need more work, where perhaps we have it hopefully much right, and we don't need to necessarily do very much more work on. We have three hours to go through the papers. Yes, 3 months by month might be about right, but no, 3 hours to go through the papers. So we're going to have to be quite organised about how we go through the discussion. What we'd like to do is use agenda paper 10.0 to actually take you through the key messages. So that is the set of slides towards the end of the set of papers. The set of slides just simply highlight the key messages coming out of the papers. However, if there is anything else within the papers that you would like to discuss or provide comments on, then please do feel free to do so. We just thought that would be a good way of actually organising the discussion. What we're going to do is we will take you through each of the papers individually, although I think in one or two cases we might combine a couple of papers together. We will then pause and ask you to make any questions or comments that you have on that particular paper. And hopefully we'll be able to get through all of them in the time available.
Are we doing 10.0 and all the other papers?
No, 10.0 is going to form the basis of the discussion, but we'll highlight which paper the slides in 10.0 is actually referring to. So we're not going to go through each of the papers individually. We'll use the slides to highlight the key messages from the particular paper. We have a lot of papers here, but actually this is just a high-level summary of the comments that we've received. There are lots of other things that are in the comment letters. What we will do at future meetings is we will bring additional analysis of those comments in order to help you make decisions on the individual topics when we look at them. So, as I said, this is a summary, and we will bring back further analysis as and when needed. If there are any questions on the sort of process for this morning, please speak now. If not, we'll go through and talk through the papers. So what we'll do is we'll start on slide 3, which takes you through an overview of Agenda Paper 10, which is the overview paper. The comment deadline closed on the conceptual framework exposure draft on the 25th of November, and we received 233 comment letters and attended in excess of 80 outreach meetings to discuss various different aspects of the exposure draft. Slide 3 summarises both the types of respondents that came back to us in the comment letter analysis and also the region and the geographical spread of those comment letters. If we turn to slide 4, this summarises sort of the main headlines, if you like, to take away from the feedback that we've got. Most of those who commented on the issue actually expressed support for the conceptual framework project, saying that this is a high priority project for the board and that we should look to finalise the project. I don't think we had anybody saying that actually we should stop work on the conceptual framework at all. And I think that feedback was also reflected in the agenda consultation. I think we've got some discussions on agenda consultation later on today, and I think the feedback in the agenda consultation is consistent with that, this idea of the conceptual framework should be a priority project for the board. Some people responding to the exposure draft said that they saw the exposure draft as a significant improvement on both the existing conceptual framework and the proposals in the discussion paper. However, we did have a significant number of comments from people saying that some aspects of the conceptual framework exposure draft need more work. And in particular, people highlighted the areas of measurement and OCI. And when we come to talk about those topics later on today, we'll highlight the reasons why people thought more work on those areas were needed and some suggestions for what that additional work might be. If you remember, when we restarted the conceptual framework project back I think it was 2012, we decided that we weren't going to undertake a fundamental reconsideration of all aspects of the conceptual framework. Instead, what we were going to do is focus on updating, clarifying, and filling in gaps in the existing framework. And we have received quite a lot of support for that idea, for the idea of continuing along that approach of updating, clarifying, and filling in gaps rather than doing a fundamental reconsideration. We had quite a few comments on the timetable for the conceptual framework. A few people saying that the board should not rush to finalise the conceptual framework if doing so would compromise on quality. However, I think there was general support for not holding up the conceptual framework for areas such as the distinction between liabilities and equity, additional work on financial statement presentation, or additional work on measurement. But again, we'll touch on those as we get into the into those areas later on in today. I've already touched on the idea that people said we shouldn't hold up the project for the distinction between liabilities and equity, and I think many expressed support for the decision to address the distinction between liabilities and equity in the separate FICE project rather than looking to address it within the conceptual framework itself. However, many people emphasised that we should give the FICE project quite a high priority going forward, that it wasn't satisfactory not to deal with it in the conceptual framework, and to leave questions about the distinction between liabilities and equity open for a long period of time. The other sort of major theme coming out of the comments was a number of people encouraging the board to undertake some more extensive effects analysis on the conceptual framework. For example, some people suggested that we should look at what effect the conceptual framework proposal would have on future standard setting, looking at in more detail at inconsistencies between existing standards and the proposals in the conceptual framework. And then also we have some people suggesting that what we should be doing is testing the proposals for the revised definitions of assets and liabilities in more detail before finalising the conceptual framework. We will talk about this idea of effects analysis in a little bit more detail at this discussion that we're going to be having at next month's meeting. So that's just a very high-level overview of the top-level messages coming out of the exposed draft. Does anybody have any questions or comments on those?
Firstly, on page 4, it seems you use different words about how many people comment on the second bullet point. In the bullet point, you sum, but orally you use a significant other of the commentators. Is this correct?
Sorry, wait. Said on page 4.
No, bullet point 2. However, here you sum. But when you already describe, you use another word.
Or could you clarify, you use some, most?
Okay. Obviously, this is all very subjective when we're using terms like some, a few, many, most. What we try to do consistently in the papers is, when we talked about a few, we were talking about literally a handful, no more than that, when talking about a few people making a particular comment. Some was more than a few, but less than many, so we're talking about more. not a majority of people, but a significant number of people actually made a comment on it. Many, we're generally talking about more than 50%, a significant number. If we talked about most, we were talking about nearly everybody making a particular comment. So that was the general approach. Obviously, it's more of an art than a science when talking about these things, particularly when you're looking at some respondents being groups of people versus individuals and that sort of thing. So it is quite difficult to be precise, but that was the general sort of way we were looking.
I think Weber was saying he wasn't sure you used the word some when he presented the second bullet point, but you mean some.
Okay. It could be some. It could be some. It could be a few on that one. I would need to go back and actually look at the rest of the calendar.
John Wolfe.
Thank you. on the respondents, there are many Chinese students who have made good comments, I guess. So are there any fresh ideas that contaminate by existing traditional concepts?
No. The Chinese students, I suspect what happened there was that a professor at a Chinese university set as an assignment his students to respond to our comment letter analysis. But what tended to happen was that the students responded to perhaps one question or perhaps part of one question rather than the whole document itself. That there were some good ideas within the sort of comments we received from the Chinese students, but I don't think anything particularly novel or new was suggested in that.
This is part of our educational efforts. Gary.
Thank you. And I'll take it that the reciprocal of most is few, you know, with our language. When we write our drafting guide, and we want to put some of those. Just one question this morning, and I'm asking now because I don't think it comes up later. And I agree with keeping the FICE project separate from this, but we've done a lot of work on FICE. Is there anything we've learned in there that can get incorporated into the conceptual framework final product? Even if it's only a little bit, you know, recognizing there still is a big project to go on it.
Manual is probably the best position to answer that.
Yeah, I think the only thing we might need to be careful about is we haven't exposed any of that work that we've done in the FICE project for comment.
Appreciate that. Maybe we're something we can put in that.
I mean, we'll always look for areas where we might potentially improve what we proposed in the conceptual framework, and of course, if we can identify ways that we can not completely future-proof it, but lay some groundwork where we can limit any potential changes, then we'd identify that. But I think that's something that we would have to look into when we look at the particular topics and, you know, the definition of reliability, supporting guidance, and definition of equity.
Thank you. I think we have to define what is the finalizing conceptual framework for now, and what is the living document is all about. I think it is quite important. You know, there is a lot of inconsistency with conceptual framework, between conceptual framework and standard. To solve the inconsistency is very important, but I don't think it is the final goal of revisiting conceptual framework. So then we have to put some new status to the current conceptual framework documents, like a living document or working draft or current draft, and put a new status to it and make it on the bound volume to make it prominent enough. So like it's something like a treasure box of intelligence, because I don't think it's quite difficult to finalize it like a standard. It's not a standard. If it's a standard, we can finalize it, and everybody must comply with it. But in the case of conceptual framework, it wouldn't work like that. Conceptual framework is something like a reference point. So then, still, working draft would provide, you know, good information to the users and ourselves and the preparers. So we should put some new status to this current.
Tak, if we call it a working draft, when would we stop calling it a working draft?
At some point we could stop, but I don't think we really need to stop it, because if we call it a living document, then it can be, you know, working draft always should be okay, but of course we have some kind of point to make it finalized in order to put it on the bound volume. But you know,
we can call it either the search for the Holy Grail or
something Something
I, like I, that. Yeah, I don't think that would be very wise. I mean, we have to, at a certain point, put an end to this project, and we all know that that will not be the final word about the conceptual framework. That probably in 5 years' time we have another go at it, and in the meantime we do a lot of useful work. But I don't think we're going to publish something which says, well, this is a working draft to be continued by the future generations of ports. To some extent, that's true for all of our standards. Mm-hmm.
But if that is the case, then what is the time frame? So we finalize it, then it's not finalized for another 30 years. So it's just a final.
We don't know. I mean, it might very well be if we, you know, if for example the FICE project, if it comes up with some clear answers, that we could make a very short addition to a conceptual framework as we publish it. We could also decide, well, it's fine as it is in the standard, and we'll just wait for the next round to include it. In the meantime, everybody knows that we have developed this.
Could I just read you what it says at the end of the purpose and status section at the moment? It says the conceptual framework will be revised from time to time on the basis of the board's experience of working with it, which I think captures quite well where we aim to be.
So we already say it's a working draft.
A working draft.
I think the comment letter reflected that idea that actually, and people use the term living document rather than working draft. So we had people cautioning against the idea of revising the conceptual framework every 5 minutes because they said you needed some stability. Mm-hmm. But equally, they encouraged us that if we did come across things that we thought we could significantly improve the conceptual framework by incorporating it into the mm-hmm. conceptual framework, we shouldn't be scared of doing that. And I think those sorts of questions about, living document ideas, we were planning to discuss at the strategy meeting next month.
I'd hate to think that our standards are dead documents.
Frozen. It's frozen.
It's all, wordplay, this. Daryl.
Perhaps an overall comment and a sort of response a little bit to what I think Tuck was saying, but the opposite side. I found it interesting the focus on testing and effects review in terms of conceptual framework. And just generally thinking about it, there would be one of three ways I would think that we could think about understanding the effect of the conceptual framework. The first is how it changes existing standards that we already have in practice. The second is how we would see a changing standard that we are still developing. So would it have an effect on developing process of standards? And the third is that it how it would affect areas where we do not have standards at all. Did you get a feeling from the requests for us to test in the various places that it came up, which they were thinking about, or was it broadly just a feeling that people wanted to understand in the broadest possible context what the testing would be, or what the outcome would be?
I think it was the broader context. A few people focused on particular areas, as, for example, focused on conflicts with existing standards. But I think generally people just wanted to understand, well, what does this mean for the future, and what could this mean for changes to existing standards, changes to standards in development, all that sort of thing.
Pretty much is all of, when they think about testing, they really want to know all the possible outcomes of a change.
Yeah. Some of the,
One of the problems with that argument is that you're assuming if existing standards are inconsistent with the new framework, we're going to change them. And that's a separate decision. So doing all this testing and saying, well, it doesn't fit with this standard, that standard, we don't want people to assume that we're suddenly going to change all the standards.
I think that there are two elements to it. I think in some ways it might just be a case of them better understanding what the implications are. But then, to Tuck's point, I think what that indicates is that people do think that the conceptual framework is not a document that then gets popped on the shelf. They see real changes coming out of it. And I think a living document, a draft document in that space, suggests that there's continuous change every time you sort of see. So I would certainly caution against, I think we really need to lock it down and say, okay, it's put away for a while, simply because people really do imagine that there are going to be the potential for changes coming out of this.
Yeah, we've got a spectrum of constituents, though. We've got some who say no standard should be contrary to the concepts, and everything should be locked down. So if you're of that opinion, then the testing's very important, because all of a sudden a lot of standards are going to be changed. But, you know, if you're the opinion that is what we write in the concepts, that it's for the board, and the board should be explicit when it doesn't use the concepts in the standard, then the testing's not quite so important.
One other thing, perhaps on this, it's interesting, both looking at the letters and looking at the summary of the letters, just how contradictory a lot of the comments seem to be. And particularly, you seem to get quite a lot of people up front saying it should be short and pithy, and then as soon as they get into the detail, we want examples, we want more information, we want more in-depth there. In terms of the order of the discussions we're going to have, would we look first to try and establish what we want this document to be before we start deliberating on what we think it should be? And the reason I ask that is it seems like we might need that framework just to inform the way we think about each of the different comments that we've heard on individual elements.
We had planned that next month's meeting to talk about the purpose and the status of the conceptual framework, so talking in terms of, you know, who's it primarily for, what's the status versus the standard. We hadn't thought about having a discussion about, the length of the document or in general terms its content, but that might actually be quite a good sort of framing discussion to have.
Pat? Thanks. The two comments that I took away from your presentation and paper 10, Rachel, were exactly the ones that we've been discussing here. The first in paragraph 28A about people expressing a concern not to revise IFRS standards, it doesn't resonate with me as a reader of financial statements. In the long run, I think you want an alignment of your framework and your standards. So if you want to call it aspirational, by all means, but I think over a decade, you want to get these standards aligned, and you want to do it in a way that obviously is going to make sense from a work stream perspective, and not necessarily be disruptive. But ultimately, I think that should be a goal, because if you have, as a stated principle, it's okay to have a framework and principles that disagree from the framework, then I think you have to scratch your head. It really should be the exception, not the rule. And if you go back and you do an inventory and you find out, well, half of your standards don't align with your framework, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. The second point is with respect to the project that Manuel is leading, and that's the what we call FICE. If you go back to a paper that he shared with us, the cover paper in February, he laid out very, very nicely in the appendix A and B, but particularly B, the areas where the three proposed approaches that he's developed align with IS 32 and the conceptual framework. And there are some significant gaps. One is shares redeemable for fair value, assuming they don't meet the putable exception. You have another instance in which you have share-settled bonds where you can deliver a variable number of shares equal to an amount independent of the entity's economic resources. Again, you have a difference between 32, the ED, and what is the proposed gamma approach. So if, in fact, we go down the path of finalizing the framework and then we're going to come up with different answers, here, we're actually heading down a path knowing that we're expecting to diverge. I don't think that's helpful to our constituents at all. So I think this is one clear area where you want to be aligned. You don't want to be diverged. To me, that right out of the box, you're saying, here's my framework, and now I'm going to make a difference over here in my first standard. That doesn't resonate with me at all.
As you know, I didn't agree with separating FICE from the conceptual framework project, but we are where we are, and most people seem to think that that's okay. But I was actually going to comment on in response to Gary's question, I would have thought that much of what may come out of the FICE project, if it continues in the direction it's going, and we haven't put anything out for comment yet, given the timing of the two projects, it's more likely that we'd see consequences as a second step. And I don't, even though that wasn't my first preference, I don't think it's the end of the world in the sense that that could be sort of immediate proof to the world that this is really a live document now. It's not changing on a daily basis, but as we need to, we are updating the concepts to reflect our most current thinking. And that might be quite a useful signal early on in the life of the new conceptual framework to show that we really mean it's not set and forget.
But if it takes you 5 years to do that or more, I think that kind of contradicts what you're saying.
We're done with FICE, we are...
But if it takes us that long to develop concepts, because there's some quite new thinking in what Manuel's working on, and for people to absorb it, give us comments and to work on it, then, you know, maybe that's okay.
That's why we shouldn't have done it with the concepts, because we would have held the concepts up.
I'm not agreeing with that, but given where we are now, I'm trying to be gracious.
I don't agree with that either.
We haven't exposed any of that in the for comments.
Right.
And in particular, when we published the discussion paper back in 2013, that there was just two approaches published in that discussion paper, so we didn't receive much information about what we're exploring in the FICE project. So we still need to go through that process of consultation in order to make that progress, and that's just going to take time. That's going to go beyond, I think, this project, unfortunately.
I agree with you. I'm just responding to the issue of not updating standards when you have a known conflict with the framework.
Peter?
I just wanted to remind everybody that most of the conflicts between ISO2 and the framework are there today already and aren't really changed by the ED. I mean, in a couple of areas, you know, you could discuss what we've maybe gone a bit further, but most of the conflicts are there already. So even if we don't finalise the changes to the framework now, we'd still have those conflicts.
Yeah, but of course that's why some of us disagreed with putting it out as it was. So.
Mary?
On this issue in particular around the FICE project and its interaction with the conceptual framework, I think generally we should say that the conceptual framework is our starting point for standards level activity rather than a distillation of decisions that we reach at the standards level. But I think this is one area that we carved out, in essence, in the conceptual framework project and said, we don't want to go through multiple rounds and front run the consideration that we need to do in financial instruments with characteristics of equity. And so we kind of put a marker down in the CD that says, we'll come back and look to see what, if any, further amendments are necessary once we have made more progress. And we're having both the conceptual framework and the standards level discussion, I think, and bundled together in the project that we've called FICE. And going back to Gary's idea of, is there any first hint or indication, if I step back from FICE in particular and think generally about how we manage change, I'm almost more inclined to say, if we expect that we will have some changes in this area, let's hold all the changes and make them at one time, rather than dribbling them out in a series of, you know, the first indications now in the direction we think we're heading, and then maybe when we get further along with FICE, another round of change. I kind of feel like don't do it in pieces. Let everybody say, okay, now we're going to focus on this area, think about what we need to do, get our, you know, not just our minds around it, but also our stakeholders, and then decide all with all the moving pieces at one time what we're going to do in that area. So that's just, it's a comment specifically about FICE, but it's also, if there's anywhere else that we look at the conceptual framework and say, we can identify very specific follow-on steps, then I think the question is, do we make a partial change now, or do we hold it all to do as one step, even though normally you'd start from the conceptual framework and then move to standards level?
Okay, I suggest we move on.
If we turn now to slide number 6, I'd just briefly like to touch on the user outreach that we conducted. That is all summarised in Agenda Paper 10M. We received 19 comment letters from users and investors as part of the feedback on the exposure draft. Got a significant number there from the UK, which I think was probably reflecting the UK interest in the prudence debate and encouraging them to write in with comments on the exposure draft. We conducted 20 meetings, including CMAC, and a number of meetings organised jointly with EFRAG. The most frequently discussed topics that are listed on the slide, we didn't discuss every single topic with users, but instead focused on those areas that we thought were likely to be of most interest to them. The feedback that we received from the users, I don't think was significantly different from the feedback that we received from other respondents. Where we did highlight any particular differences, then we've tried to highlight that within the papers themselves. So unless there are any particular comments on the user feedback summary, I propose we go through the rest of the slides, and if you have any comments about particular user views, you bring them up in respect of the individual papers. In which case, we could move on to slide 7 and Yelena.
Thank you, Rachel. So we are now moving on to agenda paper 10A, which summarizes feedback on chapter 1, the objective of general purpose financial reporting. The change proposed in the D to this chapter was increasing the prominence of stewardship within the objective of financial reporting. And many respondents representing both cross-section by geographical region and by the type of respondent agreed with this idea. In addition, some of them asked for more guidance on the term stewardship itself and how it relates to accountability. Some respondents also asked us, again, as Rachel said earlier, to tell what the impact would be on future standard setting. And here, on this topic, they would ask, they would normally raise an issue of how it could affect disclosures or selection of measurement bases. These were the most often referred to topics. Then, they wanted us to clarify better this link between the discussion of resource allocation decisions, that is the buy, sell, and hold decisions, and the discussion of stewardship and how information requirement may be different between those two. Some respondents, and here these respondents were mostly European, wanted stewardship included as an additional separate objective of financial reporting, and a few of those also thought that it should be a primary objective. And there was another group of people who disagreed with increasing the prominence of stewardship and wanted the objective of general purpose financial reporting to stay as it is now in the current conceptual framework. So this was the only change we proposed to this chapter. However, we also received some comments on the description of the primary user group, and as we previously received the comments on the discussion paper, the comments were similar, with some respondents wanting to expand it and some wanting to narrow it down to shareholders holders of ordinary shares only. So with this, any questions or comments?
One thing that struck me in the comment letter analysis, but also in the outreach meetings that I attended on ED when I was in Australia and New Zealand, was the fact that some people who agree with the introduction or the increased emphasis on the notion of stewardship, but also some who are concerned about that. Their reason for their thinking is that it seems that some people equate stewardship with a greater use of historical cost accounting. And I hadn't thought about that until we'd published the document, because to me, when I think about stewardship, I would have thought that current measurement was pretty useful, because I could assess whether or not there'd been good decisions based on the sort of current value of stuff that management had spent their money on. So to me, it wasn't something that was skewing me towards cost accounting. But I very much got a flavour from people that were concerned about the introduction of the term, that they thought that people were pushing us to include the word because they saw it as a basis for arguing that they needed more cost-based measurements because it's less volatile. And that worries me a little bit if we're being encouraged to put in a word where we're thinking about it in one way that's completely different to what those supporting it might be sort of angling for. And so when we look at this, I think it would be good to think through whether or not what we mean by that use of stewardship, what sort of information might be consistent with a stewardship view, and how that may or may not be different to other perspectives. And if that isn't our thinking, that it's therefore good to use more cost-based measurements, maybe we need to think about ways to make that clear in our re-deliberations.
But I wouldn't get too carried away on how many people think it would lead us to historical cost. Some of them do, but I don't think the majority of people pushing for stewardship think that way.
I don't think so either, but if we're thinking about it more neutrally, I think somehow we just need to get that message through in terms of what our intent for the word is, so it doesn't cause us problems down the track.
That same logic applies to the concept of prudence.
Well, also they liked it because they thought it helped with conservative or asymmetric prudence. So similar concern.
Daryl?
I think a fairly similar point to the one Sue's just made. What was interesting about stewardship is it came up in this particular paper, and then it pops up in a couple of other papers where people interpret what they think the outcome of a focus on stewardship would be. And just to emphasize, I think when we come back to consider stewardship, it would be useful to pull all those strands together, because it is helping just kind of understand where people are going with that.
Chuck. Thank you. I found a very interesting comment which asked us to interlink our mission statement and the conceptual framework. And our mission statement says our work serves the public interest by fostering trust, the growth and long-term financial stability in the global economy. That is what we are saying in the mission statement. And also, I found very good, beautiful rhetoric in the this paper.
And me too, I found it too.
It's a beautiful rhetoric. In modern capital market, the majority of economic actors are working with other people's money. And solid accounting standards that impose discipline and rigor in the financial reporting are essential for containing this moral hazard. So actually, this is very clear. We should bring some kind of discipline or rigor into the capital market so that we can serve to the stability of the capital market, and so that we expect the prospects of a global economy. So then, I don't think we have to change the substance of the conceptual framework, but we could make some interlink to explain why our conceptual framework serves to our mission statement. So it's very important. And also, I think it is quite important for us to define what the stewardship is all about, because as we pointed out in the past, there are a variety of translations, but it's not just a translation. Many people have a different meaning of stewardship. Different people have different meaning. So therefore, I think we need to define it. And also regarding primary users, we talk about buying, selling, and holding. So it somehow implies like a short-term investors. Although holding includes long-term holding, but still as a rhetoric, it implies short-term investors. So we can articulate all these things, and so that we can, this is for us to achieve our mission statement.
I agree with Tuck that we probably need to do a little bit more work here. And I think we have to explain better that stewardship is basically the accountability of management to its investors, that it is carefully working with the capital of of investors or creditors. And I truly think, first of all, I don't think anybody here will dispute what we say in our mission statement, that accounting is extremely important for holding management to account. And I don't see that. I mean, obviously, that is extremely closely linked to buy, hold, and sell decisions. But it's more than that. You can not have any plan to sell your investment in a company, but you want to hold management to account about remuneration or about a failed takeover. And that is something. It is quite closely connected, but it's not the same as buy, hold, and sell decisions. And I think a lot of people feel uncomfortable with that the fact that we see everything in the extension of buy, sell, and hold. So I think we need to do a little bit more work here, and it's just words, but words have a meaning. Mary?
two things in this area, thinking about future papers and discussion. As a couple of people mentioned in this area, it might be helpful if the staff could think for our re-deliberation on about stewardship, if we can say a bit more about what kind of information we think a focus on stewardship would mean. I'm not sure that it would go into the conceptual framework, but it might be the kind of material that we even include in the basis in terms of explaining why we think it, if we do ultimately conclude it's important to make that change, even though we generally weren't looking at this, you know, section or looking to re-deliberate this section of the conceptual framework. And the second thing is in the area about whether or not stewardship should be elevated further to a separate objective. I mean, my first reaction to the comments is I haven't been persuaded to look at it differently than what we propose. But when I look at paragraph 13 of paper 10A, it's raising the question of whether it's suggesting that there's information that you need for decision useful that you don't need for stewardship and vice versa. And I think, and then the paragraph 15 gives the example that's raised of something that might be needed for decision useful but not for stewardship, at least in the view of the commentator. I can't think of any examples where you'd need something for stewardship that wouldn't be decision useful. And I'd like the staff to see not for now, but for our discussion of this point, if you have been made aware of any examples of that latter one, because if everything that's useful for stewardship is also fits in under the decision useful, then it to me, in terms of logic analysis, kills needing to elevate it further.
So I think there's absolutely no conflict between stewardship, holding management to account, and decision useful information.
Yeah.
Because holding management to account involves a lot of decisions.
Yes.
But it is, I think, in people's minds, with decision useful information, they only connect it to buy, sell, and hold. Mm-hmm. And it's more than that.
Mm.
I still think primary objective is to deliver decision useful information to investors. I think stewardship is on an even at par with buy, sell, and hold.
Yeah. Well, on an even par with suggest elevating stewardship further than we did in the exposure draft. And that's something, well, I don't think we should, I haven't thought we should go there. I don't think we should go further. I think it's maybe explaining the interrelationship of the two. I just wanted to flag up that area in terms of what the staff brings back to us in the subsequent debate.
So I think the way we wrote it down, it is still a function of buy, sell, and hold. And that is simply not correct.
Yeah.
That is not correct.
I agree. Hans, I wonder, I don't think we are elevating it. In the public sector accounting standards board, we had a huge debate when we were doing concepts on stewardship and accountability, which they said in the public sector was more important than decision usefulness. But once you went through the argument for 3 or 4 days, I think we worked out that decision usefulness is more than buy, sell, and hold.
Exactly, that's exactly.
And part of it might be you want to change the management. You have a look at the results, and you're not going to sell your shares, but you're going to kick the board out and put another board in it. But that's all decision making.
Yeah.
And so I think if you
so at the as top remains decision making, right. Decision and useful information.
And I was referring to the comments we got that said create a second objective for financial reporting,
the overarching objective is decision useful information.
Right.
But the components are the buy, sell, and hold, and holding management.
I think we are, but I just think that we should do a discussion exactly on this point, because it is something that has come up in both the DP and the ED in terms of the responses. Make sure we have a discussion on point about it.
And the other point on accountability, we also had that debate at the Public Sector Accounting Standards Board, and we just said the two were the same.
Mm-hmm.
And accountability in some ways is easier to translate than stewardship. Stewardships are hard to put into other languages, but
I wouldn't be opposed to
Yeah, but we came to the conclusion, rightly or wrongly, that they were the same thing. Two different words saying the same thing.
But it's in our mission statement, we don't use the words stewardship, we do use accountability left and right. Because it's more precise and less difficult to understand for people outside the United Kingdom. Sue?
Just building on Mary's request for things to think about, I agree with everything that's been said in terms of understanding the information, and I also think it's part of the same thing. It's an expression more than a concept, I think. But one point that I remember came up when we were deliberating it, and I see that it came up at least from some in the comment letters, was the potential for any possible conflicts between the information that might be considered useful for, I don't know, decision useful versus stewardship purposes. I've never been able to think of any of those examples, but if in raising those concerns anybody gave examples, I'd be interested to know what they are, just so I understand whether there really is an example or whether it was just an observation that wasn't.
And one of the examples that was given is the one you talked about earlier, that something that for stewardship purposes, for example, historical costs should be selected rather than fair value. And they see this as one of the possible conflicts.
Well, I'd like to understand why they come to that conclusion so that we understand what the consequence of the word might be.
So let's carve out the time to have that discussion.
Chang Wu?
Thank you. Yeah, I agree with that issue of stewardship, but I'd like to recommend you to investigate more on the justification of why their stewardship is so important and so different from the kind of valuation perspective. As Mary suggested in paragraph 13, their ICAS, Scotland, Scottish Institute, you know, they suggested some very good justification why stewardship is different. So to contact those some organizations, whether they have some kind of additional justification why stewardship is different. Basically, the reason why I'm suggesting is it's not clear. As Mary said, we are not persuaded much to change our mind, so we need to collect more evidence and more justification. In addition to that, why we should do that is we are considering the expansion of our scope into maybe non-profit organization, or integrated reporting, or social reporting, social responsibility. You know, this kind of thing is not related directly to valuation. So there is another thing we should consider is based on some economics and accounting, contracting and with management is a really big issue, so-called agency theory. To some people it suggested this is a different decision area, but still not directly but indirectly related to the valuation of the stock prices, the ultimate indicator of the that covers everything inside of the firm company's business. However, in the short term there are different decisions, so that's what I'm saying. We are expanding scope our relevance of this organization, but however, we are narrowing down the traditional top of financial reporting into a very narrow scope of evaluation. So that's what I'm saying, based on this kind of old history and background and very nice comments from many good organizations, so to make a very informed decision whether we should make some kind of change on this stewardship, we need to have a more justification. That's what I'm suggesting you to do. Thanks.
Just one more comment from my side. I hope we will not have a huge discussion about who's the audience of financial reporting, because to a great extent I find that a bit of a nonsensical discussion, since just about everybody is an investor through his pension fund or a potential investor. What really bothers me in the current conceptual framework is that sentence that regulators may find financial information, financial reporting interesting, but they are not the primary audience. I mean, if they do their work properly, they work on behalf of investors and on behalf of creditors. So I think they are an agent of at least of the primary audience, and the fact that that we say that they may find financial reporting interesting, where it is just such an essential component of what of their work. So, you know, I will not propose to elevate them to primary audience, but let's at least not say that they don't belong to the primary audience, because I think they are. They do belong to the primary audience. Philippe.
Yeah, in the various outreach activities I participated in and in some comment letters, I found an interesting discussion about the link between accountability, stewardship, whatever we call it, and business activities, i.e. the idea that accountability or stewardship cannot be assessed in absolute terms, but only in relation to a mission given to management by investors, shareholders. There is a business plan, there is a business mission, a statement of activities, direction, strategic direction for the entity. And that could be called business activities or whatever. And this is against that contract that investors will assess the performance of management. And I don't know whether we can do anything in this respect, try to highlight this notion that stewardship is always a relative assessment, not an absolute assessment. And that you can have a very good management doing the best possible thing in the context of a given market, a given activity, a given industry. That doesn't mean that investors will not sell their shares, because they might find better opportunities in a different market, different country, different activity, emerging new markets. And still management is doing its best. So the notion of selling, buying shares, allocating resources is one fact, one element, but stewardship is something which is maybe also in parallel, because management cannot be held responsible for sometimes new development in new markets or new technologies. They have to stick to the mission which has been given to them by investors, by shareholders, until a point where investors decide to change strategy. Maybe management will propose a change in strategy. But I think this interesting notion of stewardship versus business plan or business or versus the strategy of the entity, and not in absolute terms.
Peter?
A couple of points on regulators. First of all, I think there's a distinction between saying that if financial statements are designed to meet the common information needs of a wide range of users, they're likely to be highly useful to regulators as well. But that's different from saying that they might be designed to meet their specific needs, as for the specific needs of any other users. Secondly, we should remember that regulators aren't just securities regulators. You might assume that security regulators, to some extent, are there in the shoes of investors, but there are other regulators as well. I remember on an occasion on one of our long-running projects where a prudential regulator argued very strongly that we shouldn't make some information transparent because it would enable companies to work through problems.
Yeah, I know that, and I know where this is coming from, because this is coming from the period in which we were under huge pressure, among others, from prudential regulators to not come up with transparent standards or to come up with an expected loss model, which is basically a prudential standard. So I see that problem. But to state, and there you, what you see there is that they are trying to mix their task with ours. But obviously for regulators to do their work properly, their starting point is our information.
Of course.
And obviously they belong to, and we talked with them left and right. And let's not pretend that we do not do that, and we should do that. So to say that they don't belong to the primary audience, I find that really it's ridiculous.
But I think it's because of we're trying to meet the common needs of the primary audience, not specific needs of subparts of the common audience.
I think Hans is just suggesting we're trying to express.
But even every part of the audience has different interests. There are creditors, there are investors, they have different interests. And often creditors, like the rating agencies, they also have a preference for conservative accounting because that gives them more security. Should we then say they don't belong to our primary audience because they ask us to do things that we don't like?
You know what my view was.
Yeah, no, but I mean, I have been in the public speeches extremely critical of the mingling of prudential desiderata with accounting. So I'm completely aware of that discussion, but I just, well, I'm going to
You just want
myself.
Us to try and express it.
I think it is completely ridiculous to write down sort of regulators don't belong to our, if they might find it interesting what we do, but we don't really do it for them. It's odd.
But Hans, if you say regulator is also among the primary, who is not primary?
Well, just about everybody and his grandmother.
Can I make another point about management as primary users, as potential primary users? We tend to exclude them at the moment, saying they can rely on other sources of information. That is true. But at the same time, the best corporate governance practices tend to align internal assessment of performance with external reporting, and not to make a divergence between the ways management is assessed internally and the ways you communicate to shareholders. And the alignment of performance assessment and management, internal management of the entity and external communication tends to make the management a user of the same information as provided to external users. Hence, management can be seen as users as well, because they will use the same information as provided to external parties to manage the company. And that should be, in a way, encouraged and not discouraged by saying, oh, they rely on something else. It's true they rely on a lot of additional information. In fact, they use additional information doesn't mean they don't use that information provided to the market.
Just a point of clarification, Philippe. I think what the conceptual framework says is the primary users are those that can't demand that information themselves.
But it's not the way it is understood. It is not the way. In outreach activities, people do not understand that message this way. We could clarify and explain that, of course, management is also using that information. By the way, they use a lot of extra information.
Yeah.
Because we communicate in a way which says, well, they don't use that information.
Well, it's not, yeah. Maybe we can articulate it better, but I think we'd need to be careful not to inadvertently imply that as long as it's enough for management, it's enough for everybody else, given they've got a whole extra source of information, which isn't what you're suggesting.
I agree, but the basic message is not very well communicated.
It's hard to tinker at this stage, though, given that it's about to go. Next stage is final, so.
But the point we're trying to make isn't that these other groups aren't using the information, it's which needs are we designing the financial statements to meet?
Yeah, that's true.
Martin?
I mean, I think if we should not extend this primary user, because I see it really linked to this materiality thing which we have also discussed and have our practice statement, because I mean, if it's too broad, I think as a preparer you cannot make really materiality decisions if you don't know, okay, who is the primary user? Is it the regulator? Is it the grandmother or whoever it is? Because then it is really difficult to make that. So I think we should focus really on what we have. Secondly, I think with the stewardship, man, I really will find it difficult if we make it even more prominent, because man, I see really conflicting things if it is then you have to decide, okay, is it really be doing that to give investors basis for decision, or is it really to judge how well performed management has done it? Because man, if you think about that, man, what happens in companies, man, they looking at benchmark with industries, because maybe then to say is a management was that a good decision or a bad decision, because you can only judge it when you have stable markets, because man, on absolute numbers you can't do that. You have to take it in relation to, okay, how the industry has performed, other companies has performed, and if we're doing that and come to a decision which kind of measurement we should take, I find it difficult if we then have always to say, okay, is it, should we focus on stewardship or should we focus on decision useful for investment decisions? I agree it is also for stewardship, but I think we should, and I'm convinced we should have this primary goal of decision useful for making investment decision, because otherwise, I think if we come to individual decision, I think it can be very, very difficult then to separate between what is more.
Management will also make decisions based on information.
and to the possible extent that it will be the same information used for making decisions as the information used by external parties to invest in this company. Otherwise, there is a disconnect between the information basis used for internal decisions and external decisions. There is a problem. There is a big problem.
But as I said, man, I would, typical example, I would find if you would charge really as a performance of management, you cannot do it with absolute numbers. You have to say, for example, okay, in this current market environment, was it a good or bad management style? Because, and you can only do it if you look at peer information. What has other in the same industry others have done? And then you can maybe charge as good or bad performance.
That's why we create comparable financial information.
For example, but for example, you can also then exclude market volatility. But then you come to all these decisions making market noise and market volatility, because that is maybe then.
I think
it's not in conflict.
Well, no, because I also that is not conflict. We should not make it even more prominent than we currently have it in there.
We can discuss this further when staff comes with proposals.
Should we move on to the next paper? It's taken us 1 hour to do two papers, so I think nobody's got time to do it.
That's 3 months.
We'll move on to an easier topic, prudence and openings associated with
the election. As long as we can broadcast the game here at 7:45, I'm okay.
So we are now referring to Agenda Paper 10B on qualitative characteristics of useful financial information. In this chapter, Chapter 2, the exposure draft proposed several changes. It proposed to introduce prudence described as caution under conditions of uncertainty. It proposed to introduce an explicit reference to substance over form. It tried to clarify measurement uncertainty as an aspect of relevance, and it also proposed to keep relevance and faithful representation as the two fundamental qualitative characteristics. And many respondents supported some or all of those changes. However, of course, we had some comments on all of these topics. With regard to prudence, Many respondents agreed to reintroduction of prudence described as caution under conditions of uncertainty, or as we call it in the basis for conclusions, cautious prudence. However, some of this support was conditional on the conceptual framework itself, acknowledging that there is a possibility of selecting asymmetric accounting policies for gains and losses when it results in relevant information that faithfully represents what it purports to represent. And there were different views on who could select such policies, with most respondents thinking that it should be restricted to the board only. Then there was another group who would prefer to introduce asymmetric prudence rather than cautious prudence, and these respondents were mostly from Europe. And then there was the third group that would prefer to avoid reintroducing prudence in any form. This group represented different regions, but notably quite a lot of those respondents were from Australia and New Zealand. Now, moving on to the explanation of measurement uncertainty as an aspect of relevance, quite a lot of people agreed with it, but then there were other people who thought that it should be discussed as an aspect of faithful representation or as an aspect of both qualitative characteristics, or those who would prefer to reintroduce reliability as a qualitative characteristic thought that it should be described as an aspect of reliability. And depending on this, their views on the trade-off also differed, with some thinking that there should be a trade-off with relevance and faithful representation, some thinking about a trade-off between relevance and reliability as it was in the pre-2010 framework. And there were a number of people who were talking about a trade-off between presenting information on the face of the financial statement or disclosing it in the notes. So in a way, there was a trade-off between presentation and disclosure. Another short remark on uncertainty, that some people mentioned that it is not only measurement uncertainty that we should be discussing in the conceptual framework, that we should be talking about it broader. And then one final point from me, that although most respondents agreed to keeping relevant and faithful representation of the two main qualitative characteristics. Again, as on the discussion paper, we had comments from a number of people who would prefer to reintroduce reliability as a fundamental qualitative characteristic. So I won't take any more time.
Thank you. I was struck by the comment in the paragraph 14b, which says the using unbiased instead of neutral could avoid lots of misunderstanding. I think it's true. We are discussing what is the prudence is all about. Is it the cautious prudence or asymmetry prudence or whatever? However, is it because the word prudence is difficult, or the word neutral is difficult? And actually, neutral implies something like a mathematical central. But we didn't mean that neutral should be mathematical central. What we mean is it should be unbiased. So if we change the word from neutral to unbiased decision or something, it could alleviate lots of difficult discussion about prudence.
Although I think unbiased also has some mathematical connotations attached to it as well. It's that usual problem of whatever language we pick, it's going to have associations with it. And I think our problem is to clearly define what we mean by a particular term. I think whatever language we pick, it's going to be different.
Yeah, it's a matter of language, but the unbiased contains some judgment.
But can you... because all these people who want asymmetry, they all say we want either neutrality or unbiased. We don't want biased. We don't want unneutral information.
Yeah.
But how can you, how can we, how can these two definitions, asymmetry and unbiased or neutral, how can that go together?
Yeah. Yes. On this point, I found another good comment, which says we should introduce the word credibility. The most important thing is to assure the credibility of financial statement. So if that is the case, we could introduce the characteristic of credibility to cover all these qualitative characteristics. So then the unbiased means, in order to achieve the credibility of the financial statement, it should be unbiased. It doesn't mean that the mathematical central, but it means that unbiased to achieve the credibility of financial statement. And then automatically, then what is the prudence is all about, we can understand.
Gary?
Thank you. Jolene, just a few comments on the different definitions of prudence. I actually think we have it right in the concept statement about cautious prudence. And I think that's the way most preparers, at least those that are, trying to do the best job they can, would look at it. I think asymmetrical prudence was always, conservatism by another word, was always a problem in the preparer community, whether it's debits quicker than credits or debits to P&L and credits to equity. I mean, first of all, they complicate things. But if I would suspect if that's just another, if it's a fancy word for using conservatism, we should just probably use conservatism. I suspect that's better understood and better translatable. I don't agree with it because ultimately it's a form of bias in my judgment. And usually never a problem when you're trying to set up a reserve. It's when you're going to try to use it when you don't otherwise need it, gets to be the problem. So you have built-in complications going down the line. So I think cautious prudence is exactly the right way to look at it. You got, in theory anyways, an equal chance of being too high or too low in your estimates. At least to my way of thinking, I also think asymmetrical prudence probably conflicts a little bit with the notion of fair value, and we try to get as much towards fair value as we can in standard setting, because fair value would not be have an asymmetrical piece, or have a contravening one that kind of cancels it out. Then just lastly, I think uncertainty is just a fact of life. Most of our numbers are port numbers in financial reporting are estimates, and they're estimates because there's a degree of uncertainty or imprecision or whatever. So I think on balance, I think we have it about right.
Mary?
General observation about this chapter and things to explore, not explore. I think it's important that we remember that we went into this saying, this is a chapter we're not going to change and re-deliberate, with very selected exceptions. And so, well, I think when we're at the ED stage and looking at the feedback, it very often is there anything that's come in the comment letters, especially given that we've consulted once before at the DTP stage, that causes us to, you know, fundamentally reconsider our approach. I don't expect that everybody's going to agree with it, but is it some new perspective, or, you know, we had misjudged the weight of opinion before? And if not, I think we basically look at this, especially when we said we're not going to make changes to this chapter with a few limited exceptions. Important ones, but few limited exceptions, that we keep that in mind to avoid scope creep and this becoming very late in the game a reconsideration that we said we weren't going to do. And to that point in particular, when you bring the follow-up papers, I don't think I saw anything in here about whether we got any comment or not, about whether people thought it was important or not important to stay aligned with the, you know, the work that had been done jointly with the FASB in this area. You know, we had said these are the limited changes that will create some difference. In general, we hear messages, but maybe they're more at the standards level, about maintaining the convergence that has been achieved to date. And I don't recall seeing much on that, you know, in this, and I'm not sure why we did or didn't. Maybe it's because we didn't ask. But let's keep that in mind too as we're looking at this section.
I was just going to respond to Mary's question about the convergence. Actually, correct me if I'm wrong, but there were surprisingly few comments about staying converged with the
past. One way or another.
Two comments. First one is about the reliability and the faithful implementation. I heard one comment I would support, and from the beginning I also support, that is whether we should move the traditional reliability notion under relevance of some part, or under faithful implementation. People say, you know, in 2010, when we revised conceptual framework on this chapter, the basic reason why we want to replace, you know, reliability by a faithful implementation is because people misunderstand the meaning of reliability, and the meaning of reliability should be the faithful implementation. Then people said, if that is the case, why will you move that part into relevance? I personally agree with you. And secondly, Tucker, I will not agree with you, Rich, introduce a new term called credibility. We already depending enough, you know, clarify the terms, a concept, among the ones we have already had, and introduce another one, and then we have to define and have to clarify the relationship among so many concepts already. Sorry.
I took a great interest in reading the comment letters on this subject, and there was one individual who sent a comment letter in who I thought was extremely thoughtful. And he's from the academic community. His name is Richard Barker. He teaches at Oxford. And one of the, I guess, suggestions he has, and I think this is shared by Anne as well, is essentially redefining what exactly we mean by this word. Now, I have an objection to the word prudence, because when I look it up in Webster or in Oxford, it gives me a definition which I think is inconsistent with the way it's described in this framework. So hence, I think you could arrive at inappropriate conclusions in its application. But I think if you actually use the words to describe what you mean, and as Professor Barker has articulated in his letter, I think you can get to a reasonable outcome. Okay.
Is it asymmetry?
No, he says basically that it's consistent with neutrality. Okay.
But he pleads for asymmetry.
No. I think basically the way I look at it is he's looking at more at it from the opposite standpoint. That's my view. Now, if in fact he's pleading for asymmetry, then I disagree with him. But I think the problem right now we have is the definition of prudence in a dictionary, okay, is more consistent with asymmetric, okay, prudence than it is with the ISB's proposed definition. And so if, in fact, the board as a whole believes that, you know, we can't move forward, we won't, you know, be able to exist without some application of this concept, then my advice is to describe what you mean more precisely, but don't use a word imprecisely. Don't say something is something that it's not. And that's what we're doing right now. That's the problem I have. Mm-hmm. When I look up the word prudence in Oxford, I see one definition. I look up the word in the conceptual framework, I see something different.
Well, I'm very surprised that you are sympathetic to it. And I agree it's a very thoughtful paper by Professor Baxter, but it's completely opposite to what you usually plead for.
I read it the other way around, okay? And I think
let's do a reading class together.
He's recommending something that I think we can work with.
Opposite.
I think there were two aspects to what Richard was recommending in his paper. Firstly, actually, I think he does argue that asymmetry has a role to play in financial reporting, and whether you call it asymmetric prudence or what you call it, then I think he argues that it has a role, and he would advocate that we acknowledge that in the conceptual framework. The second aspect, which I think perhaps is what you were picking up on, Pat, was that he believes that the way in which we have used the term prudence in the conceptual framework in terms of cautious prudence isn't the way in which most people actually understand the term. We recommend that we move away from using the term prudence because of the potential confusion.
But he also, yes, I agree with you. He also says that prudence is not inconsistent with neutrality. Okay. Mm-hmm. So hence, one could argue you don't need the word prudence.
But he also says you shouldn't measure things at fair value if you don't have quoted liquid.
I'm not bringing into this discussion the concept
that's
of fair value.
That's a consequence of what he's recommended.
Well, I disagree there.
I'm surprised
you agree. One of those people who say asymmetry is not conflicting with neutrality.
So
I cannot understand that.
So my recommendation is don't use the word prudence. Apply the concept that you intend. Okay, mm-hmm. Here.
Changu?
Thank you. This is paragraph 14D. There's a very interesting suggestion here to solve this issue is neutrality as a starting point in standard setting. However, if there is a valid reason for the standard to implement this kind of asymmetry, then maybe we just disclose this is a kind of asymmetric standard setting by the board. So this might be another alternative to think about to break this kind of some conflict of views. Another thing is the paragraph 17. People are thinking this prudence as a symmetric prudence rather than cautious prudence. So that's summarized in paragraph 17. So I'm wondering how many people, majority of people, are thinking their prudence as a symmetric prudence rather than the cautious prudence. So these two questions.
It is not necessarily, to your second question, it is not the majority. It was some rather than many. So it isn't widespread.
Some, not many.
Accept our explanation in the basis of what cautious prudence is. Mm-hmm. And they want cautious prudence in the conceptual framework.
Okay.
Ian? This will come into Mary's categorization of scope creep. But I thought there were interesting comments on verifiability, which I've never really understood. And the first one was to think of a notion of credibility. And the other one was making a statement that in the present concepts, verifiability is consensus-based. If two people come to the same view, then it's verifiable. And they're suggesting it should be more evidence based. And I think that's, it always tossed me verifiability from when they brought it in the last lot. I never understood what it meant. But we didn't ask the question, and it would be scope creep, I agree. So yeah. Going to insist.
Stephen?
People are always talking past each other in this area because of the difficulty of all the different terms and the baggage that comes with them. But, I mean, it's going to be difficult when we come to redebate this, but one of my suggestion would be to think a little about neutrality, because when we had the discussion initially, we assumed, well, everybody knows what neutrality is. And in my experience from the outreach, people have different views as to what neutrality is, and I wonder whether we might, in combination with the discussion of prudence, also think more carefully about exactly what we mean by neutrality.
I agree.
But the interesting thing about all these letters about prudence is that everybody wants to say the same outcome. Everybody says we want neutral information, we want unbiased information. We don't want secret reserves.
That's the key thing, deliberate overstatement or understatement.
Yeah, so everybody says we don't want deliberate overstatement of liabilities, we don't want deliberate understatement of assets. So everybody wants the same thing, but how to get there, that's the problem.
Well, I'm not sure they do want the same thing, because yeah. I think some assume that neutrality in the framework means that to comply with that, everything has to be fair value. And I don't think that's how we mean neutrality in the framework, but these different interpretations of neutrality get in the way of a discussion about prudence. And
but I also think people mean different things when they talk about understatement and overstatement. When we say, you know, no hidden reserves, they think that's a very sort of malicious big bath, you know, type thing, whereas a bit of an adjustment that's sort of on the cautious side isn't that.
Yeah.
So I think that we're talking past each other there as well.
There's just a nostalgia for conservative accounting that gives a little bit of leeway. Yep. Okay.
So we move on then to the next paper, which is agenda paper C, which talks about financial statements and the reporting entity. That will be chapter 3 in the exposure draft. This chapter dealt with two topics. It dealt with the scope and objective of financial statements, and it also discussed the reporting entity. The comments that we received on the scope and objective of financial statements we'll take together when we discuss the presentation and disclosure a little bit later on today. So at the moment, all I'm going to do is focus on the comments on reporting entity and a few other features that we're considering in that chapter. In the exposure draft, we suggested that a reporting entity should be described as an entity that chooses or is required to produce general purpose financial statements, and describe the boundary of the reporting entity by reference to control, saying that if you had direct control only, you ended up with unconsolidated financial statements, but if you had direct and indirect control, then you ended up with consolidated financial statements. There was broad support for the proposals on both the description of the reporting entity and the boundary of the reporting entity. However, there were some general comments that this chapter was perhaps a little bit light and some more guidance was needed in particular areas. There were some concerns about the description of control that we use and the language we use around control in the chapter. And in particular, people were confused about the use of the terms direct and indirect control, noting that we didn't use those terms in IFRS 10 and wanted more explanation of what we actually meant by the terms. In particular, some people suggested that those terms were used in different ways in existing practice. For example, direct control, many people interpreted as meaning indirect control, many people interpreted as meaning that you were controlling through subsidiaries. So there was some confusion over the use of the word. There was some support for the discussion of combined financial statements, and many people welcomed the idea that we discussed combined financial statements in the chapter. However, many people asked for more guidance on when combined financial statements might be appropriate and how to determine the boundary of those combined financial statements. We included in the exposure draft a statement that consolidated financial statements are more likely to provide useful information to users than unconsolidated financial statements, and many people objected to that statement and argued that in some cases unconsolidated financial statements would be more useful than consolidated financial statements. The chapter also included the going concern assumption with a few minor editorial changes to that assumption, and there's general support for the proposed going concern assumption in its drafting. We also briefly mentioned the perspective from which financial statements are prepared. There were mixed views on that, although relatively few people commented on it, and with some supporting the idea that financial statements are prepared for the entity as a whole. Others objected to that statement, and others asking for clarification about what that actually meant for standard set. With that, I'll open up to questions.
Gary.
Thank you. The focusing on Rachel in paragraph 34, but it's dealing with when you say many who commented disagreed that consolidated statements are more likely to provide. Using our nomenclature reciprocity, what I read that to say is few agreed consolidated statements are likely to provide.
Most was our reciprocal view, but
many is still presumes a majority.
Yeah, many is still a substantial number. And so, yes, we had a significant number of people who expressed a comment on this, said that they disagreed with that statement.
Would the logical extension of that be is that we should focus on just the parent company reporting or the direct control only, or which I guess is the parent company?
I don't think that was the argument these people were making. I think that their argument was that in some circumstances consolidated financial statements are needed, but that our statement here was underplaying the importance of unconsolidated.
Okay, and that's a different assertion than is written here. The other thing, I think we don't have to process it now, but I'd ask you to think about when you own 100% of the stock of a subsidiary, I suspect most people would probably say you have direct control. It might be one step removed, but you have direct control, and I don't think that's a word for it. If we take direct control as you immediately own it, indirect control is through voting rights, if I understand the paper correctly.
No. The way we described direct and indirect control, it was slightly different than that. And what we were talking about, and I don't think we explained it very well in the exposure draft, which is why we got a lot of comments on it, was the idea that direct control, you're looking at the assets. When you do unconsolidated financial statements, all you present are those assets that you control directly. So if you have an investment in subsidiary, you control directly your investment rather than the underlying assets of the subsidiary. But if you look at both direct and indirect control, then you would look at the assets that you control indirectly through your control of the subsidiary and end up with consolidated financial statements. That was the distinction we were trying to draw there.
We can take it offline.
We are really behind, so do we really need to discuss this relatively unimportant. can we go move?
What? Just one point about the.
If they have their.
Sorry.
I think the answer is yes.
I'm punishing. Mary and.
I was just going to say, stepping back and thinking about what the feedback is. What do we do next? This is a new section in the conceptual framework. In general, my sense is that we got confirmation for having such a section in the framework. I look at the comments that we got about please expand, please provide more guidance, please do this. And while I think those are useful inputs more from an agenda consultation perspective, I think that a lot of people are reacting to the first time we've moved forward on this. And I think that probably they're more standards level issues than they are conceptual framework ones. So I think in terms of what you bring back, you've got the right focus in terms of some of the statements around usefulness of consolidated and direct and indirect, and would encourage the staff in this one to further to Hunt's point to try and move on. We've got confirmation of the basic idea here.
Just a quick word about combined financial statements. We have in the explored a lot in the existing framework, this notion of combined. We give very little guidance and we don't have a standard on combined financial statements. And some people suggested that we might, without going to developing a standard, a full standard, just add some flesh to the framework saying combined financial statements can be prepared whenever they are useful and provide relevant and useful information, and maybe give one or two examples. And I think they would feel satisfied with that, without going to a full-fledged definition of what is the scope, etc.
Okay, I suggest we take a quick break, back 11:15.
Right, okay, we're now going to talk about feedback on Chapter 4, which is the elements of financial statements. There are three papers, and so we've got three slides summarising the key messages. Turning first to slide 11, which summarises the key messages on paper 10D, the asset definition. Many respondents commented on the definition of an asset, the proposed definition of an asset, and many of those supported or broadly supported the definition. That included most of the regulators, standard setters, accountancy bodies and accounting firms. Few users commented on the proposed definitions. Preparers were more evenly divided. And those that don't agree with the proposed definitions, most of them are concerned about the replacing the notion of expected inflows and outflows with the notion of potential to produce inflows and outflows. And they're concerned that this change, in conjunction with the proposed removal of the probability criterion from the recognition criteria, could lead to more assets and liabilities and particularly low probability certain assets and liabilities being recognised. There were no questions specifically on the proposed concepts for unit of account and executory contracts. Some respondents did comment, and probably most notably, some said they would like more guidance on selecting unit of account, and some respondents disagreed with the proposed analysis of the nature of the rights and obligations in executory contracts. Moving on to slide 12, which summarises the key messages from paper 10E on liabilities and equity. Again, there was broad agreement with the proposed definitions of a liability and the proposal to define equity as the residual. Some respondents asked the board to give high priority to addressing the problems that arise in classifying financial instruments as debt or equity, but most of those respondents agreed that the board should explore those problems in the separate project on financial instruments with the characteristics of equity and not delay finalising the conceptual framework in the meantime. In the liability section, one of the main proposals is the description of a present obligation as an obligation that the entity has no practical ability to avoid. And there was a specific comment on this, and quite a specific question on this, and a lot of respondents commented. Many, I'd say, broadly agreed with the proposed description of a present obligation, and in particular, very few argued for a much narrower or a much broader description. A notably different group amongst the respondents were the banks who responded, and they were concerned that the proposed description could have unwelcome implications for classification of claims as liability or equity. Even amongst those who agreed with the proposed description of a present obligation, some expressed concerns that it could be difficult to interpret and implement, and some asked the board to do more work to test the robustness of the description and the implications both for existing standards and for current and future projects. Finally, moving to slide 13, paper 10F dealt with proposed changes to the definitions of income and expenses and discussions of undefined elements, and most respondents expressed no objections. Most respondents didn't comment on this area, and certainly most expressed no objections to the proposals here, which was to retain the existing definitions of income and expenses largely unchanged, to remove from the conceptual framework some discussion of various types of income and expenses, and not to define elements for either the statement of changes in equity or the statement of cash flows. Now, there were some respondents who disagreed with aspects of these proposals, and in the main it was with the proposal to remove the discussion of different types of income and expenses. Obviously, if you've got comments and questions, Manuel's your person on equity and noble unit of account.
Okay. Have we spent all our energy in the early morning?
I just wanted to comment on the feedback on liabilities. I thought it was interesting, the comments from the financial institutions. And I've been at some of the meetings where they've talked about their concerns about the proposals. And I think we need to sort of take them seriously, not suggesting we wouldn't, but just because it's come from a narrow group, I don't think we should sort of think it looks odd or that they've got an agenda, because I think it just simply reflects the fact that probably the population that's got the most complicated financial instruments, where in meetings I've been to, they've already talked about the fact that making the assessments of whether or not you meet the definition of a liability today based on 32, which in this sense is lined up with the conceptual framework, can be difficult, even with no economic compulsion. And moving sort of further down that path for them, they can already see the difficult application questions and judgments are going to come up. And so I'm not sure how best we deal with that in terms of the timing of the conceptual framework versus FICE, but I think it's something we need to be careful about.
Amaru?
Same point, but just an additional information. I agree with Sue, we should be careful about because of the implications, and we do have a project going on the same. In the slides, however, you didn't mention that what you have in the very next paragraph, when you mention the bank's reaction, that the bank regulators, the BIS, did agree with the present, the application of the present obligation. But of course, this is a very high level summary, and you didn't go further saying why. Did they say specifically why they did agree?
So why they did agree, the regulator?
In opposition to the banks.
What they were seemed to be saying mainly was that they were concerned that up until now, economic compulsion hasn't been a factor that's been taken into consideration, and they felt that that was leading to instruments that were economically very similar being accounted for differently.
So they were more concerned with the inconsistent application of the classification itself, not really with the application of the concept.
More whether they agreed that the outcomes were sort of faithfully representing the substance of instruments, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, they didn't say a lot more. Basically, they didn't say much more than is in that paragraph reporting what they said, because I reported most of what they said. So, yeah.
And that was the prudential regulator. So.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Mary?
The feedback here and also some of the discussions that are during the times is that for exposure, so feedback and outreach, made me think hard and ask the staff to come back, kind of looking at projects and their interactions in this area, because while Joan, you've highlighted here that with the exception of financial institutions commenting, in general there was support for the added commentary about liabilities, etc. I think the feedback we've gotten has made me really cautious about how far we go before we get further with FICE. Because while the uncertainty that we're addressing, especially in the liabilities area, is broader than FICE, I would be very concerned about going forward and then either having, feeling constrained by that in the FICE discussions, or ending up somewhere slightly differently. So my thought, and this goes back to what I said at the beginning of our discussions as a general point, is if we think that we're going to have some changes to the liability definition potentially coming out of FICE, I tend to want to hold off making other changes, including holding off building in some of the discussion about when do you have a present obligation, the guidance, until we know what we're going to do with economic compulsion and how that economic compulsion lines up with or doesn't line up with the discussion of present obligation that has been proposed here. So I think in terms of staying away from the debate about it today, but what I asked the staff to bring back is to look at how we think what we proposed in this paper lines up with the issues that we're discussing in other projects so that we can think about how we bring the timing of the projects together and how far we go in one before we finalize the other, because I think it's that interaction we have to actively manage.
Thank you. It's a different point. There are some concerns that if we remove the probability threshold, it would increase the population of assets and liability. But of course, that is not what we intend. However, I have a slight sympathy why they worry. They worry about the basis of the population. Even though we do not increase the population of recognized asset or recognized liability, but if you put yourself into the shoe of preparer, once the definition has a broader definition, then you have to search every single transaction whether or not it meets the recognition criteria or not, or do we have to disclose it in the footnote or something. So therefore it might increase the work of the preparers. So therefore I agree with changing the definition. However, we have to explain it is not our intention to expand the scope of the research or search of the work of the preparers.
No, to come. First, I fully agree with Taka in this case, you know. And
just this case.
But on the liability aspect, Mary, I not agree with you. It's because, you know, of course there is some kind of overlap, but I think the purpose in the current ED on liability, particularly the definition or description of obligations or little bit more guidance on those which are basically liability type. And the project, you know, chaired by Manuel is something with characteristic of equity. And I personally feel it would be so, you know, unhelpful, we also delay that part to, you know, to Manuel. I would personally feel it will be useful to finalize the ones already in the current ED. Of course, we can improve by some way, but totally the delay to Manuel's hand, I would not feel so good.
Thank you. On paragraph, this is 25E.
Which paper?
Oh, sorry, 10E. Sorry. Some people are suggesting their more familiar term, no realistic alternative to setting, rather than there are no practical ability to avoid. However, we provided why we are using no practical ability to avoid rather than no realistic alternative in basis for conclusion 4.71. So, but they are still recommending this more familiar term in their area of liabilities. However, in our PC, the justification of this no practical ability to avoid is basically based on the concepts of control rather than the settling down or obligation. So maybe people are maybe somewhat not satisfied with our explanation why we are using this new term. If that new term is not accepted well enough by our people, then we better use their old ones. Then banks and financial institutions might have less, some kind of a burden they feel. You know, that's why I'm saying they're thinking about that another possibility of the old term, established term, rather than new term. That's one thing. Another comment is on paper D, that's paragraph 27E. I don't know if this statement is correct or not. Very interesting comment from one standard setter is said that the measurement of a collective bundle of rights is not necessarily the sum of the measurement in individual rights that collectively form the asset. So this is a very interesting comment. If this is true, then maybe we might think about the new suggestion on that we can think of a right for an asset. If the measurement is not consistent with these two sums, then maybe our new approach in defining an asset might have some weakness. So I'd like to suggest to you to check whether this statement of our standard setter is a correct or not. So that's the second comment.
Sue?
I'm just following on from the comments that Mary and Weiguo made about the interaction with the debt equity project and the conceptual framework, and this was one of the reasons I dissented, because of the complexity of trying to decouple these two projects, if you like. It's immediately going to make it tricky to scope the two appropriately, and I have some sympathy from what Mary said. I also have some sympathy from what Weiguo said because of the time yeah. horizon. Now, if I think about instruments with characteristics of equity, I think there's two broad types that people think about. One is sort of variable share settled stuff. I think that's easy enough to sort of park for now and say we'll come back to that with FICE, and if we need to, we'll come back to the conceptual framework. So I think that's sort of easy-ish. The one I think is trickier is these sorts of instruments where there's cash there's cash payments, and people are trying to decide whether or not they're really liabilities, whether there's really obligations or not. So the sort of perpetual preference shares with cumulative dividends that on the face of it are discretionary, that sort of stuff, and with step ups and all that sort of carry on. I'm not sure how possible or appropriate it will be for us to sort of land where we want to land on the discussion of what a liability is in the conceptual framework without at a minimum starting to get into financial instrument territory to some extent to draw the line, which I think is what Mary's getting at, because I think people are saying, the banks are saying two things. Firstly, I think some of them aren't sure they agree that there really is a liability in those circumstances, which we may or may not agree with. But I also think they're saying, we don't really understand how to make this whole assessment of what no practical ability to avoid means in the context of these instruments. We don't know how to do this. What do you mean, and what path are you sending us down? And I think to opine on what the sort of liability definition is in a no practical ability to avoid sense for a population that must in large part cover financial instruments without doing quite a bit of FI work is going to be pretty tricky for us to do. So I think we've either got to say we're not going to touch it, which is Mary's suggestion, or and we'll do with it and fight and circle back fully on that, or we've got to say no, we need to do it now, in which case somehow we're going to have to pull a chunk of the FICE thinking into this, I think, to try and help us at least make sure we've thought through the FI consequences of the wording changes. I don't think we can barrel ahead and say we'll worry about FI later and change the words in the conceptual framework.
So I think when we do bring back a strategy paper on how we manage the interaction, we'll pick up, I think, some of these points and set out what alternatives we might have, because there's a spectrum of from doing nothing to bringing some things in, or somewhere in between where we manage it by saying where we think we have clearer concepts in for some particular types of transactions, but where we think we need to do further work, for instance, as part of the FICE project and flagging that quite clearly. So there's a range of things that we might be able to consider doing.
Doug?
Thank you. Back to what Changgu pointed out about the word rights. So we simplify it. We only use the word rights only. So it's good. However, it could change the general concept of rights. It's slightly different from general concepts of right. Normally, people think the right is something like the right which was protected by legislation or a law which is enforceable. However, what we are discussing here in the rights includes some of access. And some people say it would be better to use the word access rather than rights. Especially in the case to access to the public goods. So if you have private access to the public goods, say for example private beach or something, so kind of like a private access is included in the rights. So if that is the case, we have to articulate it better. And maybe it's a bit dangerous to simplify it. It's only rights, because it could change the general concepts of rights.
Okay, we can continue.
Thank you.
Slide 14 is about recognition piece of chapter related to paper 10G. Many commented on recognition proposals, and many of them broadly agreed with the proposed approach that is based on qualitative characteristics. However, we noted preparers and users' views were sort of divided. Most of those who disagree like to keep the existing criteria, and in particular the probability criteria in the recognition proposals. Some of the concerns that we noted was that these proposals are too abstract and subjective, and they thought this could lead to more number of assets and liabilities being recognized, and in particular those with low probability of inflow or outflow of future economic benefits. And some suggested to test the impact of these proposals specifically on future standard setting, how these proposals will impact the future standard setting. Apart from this, we've also noted a few alternative suggestions as described in paragraph 29 of the paper. We also noted some additional guidance that was requested as described in paragraph 30 and 31 of the paper. And lastly, we have also noted some comments specific to cost-benefit criteria that we have described in paragraph 40 of paper 10G. With that, I'll hand over the comments.
Mary?
I had a comment here that is maybe not so much about recognition specifically, but just a general point that, again, I'd like the staff to bring back, probably in our detailed deliberations, but factor into the strategy. If you look at paragraph 22 in paper G, it says, Respondents noted that preparers are required to refer to the conceptual framework via IS-8. They thought that the absence of specific recognition criteria could result in recognizing a large number of intangibles. Customers, you know, gives the example of customer relationships, which might not provide useful information. And I'm struggling with the general, I think we need to have a general discussion of when do we think preparers need to refer to the conceptual framework for guidance on accounting policies, because to me, IAS 38 is the standard on intangible assets. And if we have a standard on intangible assets, it may not say this is what you do for customer relationships, but there is an applicable standard on the topic. So I can understand that a preparer might want to look to the conceptual framework for context that may be relevant in thinking about how you apply the principles and the standards. But the idea that you will be actively referring via IS-8 to the conceptual framework because there's an absence of an applicable standard doesn't work for me. And this has come up in several other places. So my suggestion, and I don't think, you know, good news for you is it isn't, you know, a recognition derecognition question, that we should maybe have a paper that looks at this issue of how we think the interaction works. And I don't know that it ultimately would go into the conceptual framework. It might highlight something that we want to say in IS-8 instead. But I think that's part of what's raising the tension about effects analysis and, you know, further analysis, et cetera, around the changes that we're making to the conceptual framework. And you were just unlucky enough that the example you provided in your paper prompted that thought.
Yeah, just a thought on this. So some respondents thought that wherever specific elements are not being addressed in standards, in those situations, they may have to refer to the conceptual framework. And a few of them referred to customer relationship in particular. That's why we kind of brought it out. And they thought there could be situations where such relationships are contractually defined and can be transferred separately, apart from selling the business as a whole.
Yeah.
And they thought in such situations, they may have to go and refer to the conceptual framework, and that would permit them to.
As I said, I don't think it's a paper about customer relationship intangibles or anything. I think it's just generally about the interaction of conceptual framework, ISA, and scope of standards. Yeah, that may be a useful case study to use, but it has a risk because we have papers on that in the BizCom area of getting confused with the BizCom discussion.
Sure.
I agree with Mary, both in the comment letter analysis and in the outreach I did. I'd have to say I felt that the preparers aren't going to know what to do card is being perhaps a little bit overplayed. And I think that we need to come back and really analyse how often would people really be in a situation where they need to use their themselves. Relatedly, I think partly what they really are worried about, and they're not expressing it this way, is they feel that it's so loosey-goosey they're not going to be able to hold us to account, or the board's not going to be consistent in the decisions it makes over time. If that's the case, if those are their concerns, the latter one I certainly have got some sympathy for, because the whole idea is it's meant to sort of make us more consistent in the foundation for our thinking. But I think the way we might react to it could be slightly different to if we're suddenly thinking these are criteria, you know, every preparer needs to be able to pick up and apply themselves. And so I think having an analysis that really puts it in perspective, because we've gone from sort of saying the conceptual framework is for us to saying, okay, no, there are circumstances when it's for others, but it's not every day. And I think we need to try and put that in perspective.
Okay.
In which case, Nubi, would you like to talk about derecognition?
Yes. Slide 15 provides a high level of paper 10H. Most respondents who commented on derecognition supported the proposed discussion. However, some of the respondents who commented on derecognition stated that derecognition should mirror recognition. But that's all.
Pat?
We had a good discussion on this topic 5 years ago. We had an ED outstanding, and thankfully, the board did not move forward with the proposals in that ED. I remember a comment letter from, I think it was then the chair of the Accounting Standards Board of the UK.
He was a
expressed, I thought, quite eloquently the views, at least that I shared, Mr. Smith at the time shared as well. I think introducing derecognition using a control approach in a mixed measurement model invites gain on sale accounting and all of the horrors that we saw and witnessed in the lead up to the financial crisis, the 10 years prior to that. My recommendation here is a control approach is perfectly fine from my perspective if you're using fair value measurement. I have no problem with it. But if you're using anything in the realm of historical cost, I would prefer an approach that Mr. Leisner used to call stickiness, and the risks and rewards approach there resonates more with me, because I would not like to see gains or losses for that matter booked in an environment where management has complete discretion, carte blanche, to choose, pick and choose, cherry pick, whatever they want. So that's the solution. Instead of just saying, throwing these things out and these are things for the board to use, I would say no. A control approach is usually you have assets measured subsequently at fair value, and a risk and rewards approach would be appropriate when you have assets measured at other than fair value.
Revolution. No further comments? Okay, so we can move on.
We have a new member of staff to discuss measurement. I don't think he's had much experience in standard setting, so please be nice to him.
Thank you, Rachel. I noted that I make my debut on the Ides of March. Agenda paper 10I deals with the topics of measurement and capital maintenance. The exposure draft outlined various measurement bases, their advantages and disadvantages, and that was the first major section. It then went on to discuss factors to consider when selecting a measurement basis. As set out on slide 16, there was a fair degree of pushback to the measurement chapter from those who responded on it. Quite a few, including many standard setters and other large bodies, influential bodies, suggested that the chapter needed substantial improvement and or further research. Having said that, the basic approach of saying, well, the measurement bases will vary from case to case, and so application is going to be a mixture of cost bases and current bases, was generally supported. So it's not as if there's a major camp pushing for historical cost or for fair value, including many several respondents who toyed with the idea, who noted the conceptual attraction of specifying a single measurement basis, but were nonetheless sympathetic to the general approach taken. Having said that, something that additional measurement bases should be addressed within the chapter, and that ideas such as entry-exit values and entity and non-entity specific dimensions should also be addressed. Moving on to slide 17, there's general agreement that basing the selection of a measurement basis on the qualitative characteristics is a sound approach. But there was a general concern that the chapter really wasn't directional enough. We've described the advantages and disadvantages of different bases. We talk about some of the qualitative characteristics. And we don't really build the links clearly enough to suggest what conclusions one might draw. One factor that was mentioned that attracted a great deal of support was the idea, which I think was carried over from the discussion paper, that the way in which an asset contributes to future cash flows is an important factor to consider in selecting a measurement basis. The exposure draft described that as being often linked to the nature of business activities, and the idea of business activities in that specific context drew up a significant measure of support, with only a few people opposing it.
One point which could perhaps appear in 2017 is the idea of dual measurement, the proposal that the measurement basis used in the statement of financial position might not be that used in the performance statements, and that was really got a similar response. People didn't mind the idea, but felt that the implications of it and the conceptual basis needed to be spelt out a bit further. Moving on a bit, there was also a chapter which reproduced the stuff in the existing framework, the material in the existing framework on concepts of capital and capital maintenance. That we didn't ask for comments on that, but of course we got some, and those comments were not terribly complimentary. A lot of people suggested it needed more work or to be deleted. I would emphasize that it's important to appreciate that those who made those comments weren't making it from the standpoint of saying, you know, capital maintenance is unimportant. They just felt that the chapter as it stood wasn't a credible treatment of the subject, and they would rather see it deleted than retained. So with that, I look forward to your comments and questions.
Yeah, thank you. I think we take the comment which says we'd rather delete the capital maintenance section more seriously. Actually, we didn't do anything on this wording of current capital maintenance. And it's understandable that we cannot challenge the capital maintenance issue for now. Mm-hmm. But it's questionable whether we should leave it as it is. So leaving the wording of capital maintenance as it is means we agree with the current wording. But I'm not quite sure we all agreed that the current wording of capital maintenance is correct, because we didn't discuss anything. So if we leave it as it is, then at least we have to discuss it more. And if we do not discuss, then probably to delete would be the good suggestion.
Peter.
On a different point, one thing disappointed me really in the response to the ED. I thought quite an important part of what we were trying to do was to say that when the board's selecting a measurement basis, it should look at the nature of the information that's being provided. And the way we tried to operationalize that was with a table, which summarize what we thought the information was being, what information was being provided. And the sense I got was that that really didn't resonate at all with respondents. They in fact, I think most of them barely even looked at that part of it. And I'd be a bit reluctant to lose that idea, because I thought it was quite an important part of our thought process, but maybe we need to try and find a better way to do it.
Mary?
Just generally from a strategy for the project, Tuck's comments on capital maintenance make me think that we've been burned before by things that we have taken out thinking they, you know, that they aren't used, and then kind of wishing that we hadn't done that or that hadn't happened. So maybe the point with capital maintenance is to first go back and essentially do a check of the still applicable standards to see if any refer to capital maintenance, that, you know, in a way that would make us question it again. I'm a little concerned about just taking it out because we didn't actively consult on that. So we might have heard from the people who thought it was not good to carry it forward, but we didn't hear from people who might want to keep it in. But we might need to make clear that this is something that we have not re-deliberated. I think we did in the ED. We haven't re-deliberated. We have just carried it forward as a place marker. I don't have a strong view about either one of those, but just thinking about the process. On the bigger subject in measurement, I think one of the first things that we'll have to consider is, you know, kind of a strategy direction, is the same issue that we asked going into publishing an ED, which is, we want to develop measurement more. Do we hold the whole project for it, which doesn't seem to be the sense? Do we issue it without the measurement chapter and say to come? Or do we put in something that we think is not as developed as ultimately we'd like it to be, and then when and how do we carry forward work on that? And I think making that decision will we'd have to go back and re-examine it if we can't get as far as we think or something like that. I think it's going to be critical to how much do we try to do, in the context of sending a clear signal. I think we tried to signal in the ED, and I think people understood it, that we don't think this is all that is necessary, but we think that this is what we can achieve at this point in time. But I think we have to sort out that how much we're going to try and do and what's its impact for the project.
Well, I do hope that we can achieve more in the final version of the conceptual framework. I think we pulled back too far from the discussion paper.
Yeah.
And were too neutral. And I think if by bringing back some of the analysis of the discussion paper and improving on it, I think we can probably do more. We will not get the ultimate answer, but I'm sure we can improve on what we've done thus far. We should try to do so. Stephen?
I would caution against taking out the capital maintenance framework. I mean, there seems to me to be nothing more conceptual and fundamental to financial reporting than the capital maintenance concept. The whole of our standards essentially are based upon a nominal financial capital maintenance concept, so why don't we say that? There are some special circumstances where we might look to other things with inflation accounting, one or two other bits and pieces you could argue, but let's not just dismiss this just because some people said it's not well developed.
So why did we decide not to do anything about it? Because the chapter as it is, I think, is very poor quality.
The decision was taken because we were concerned that it could actually hold up the project significantly, because it's something that people feel very passionately about, but we weren't entirely clear what implications it would have for the broader standard-setting decisions. So it was a decision about where we could best focus our efforts.
It's a big subject if you want to do it properly.
Yeah, so that's why I'm also hesitant about dropping it, because then you give off all sorts of signals that are probably not intended. But having such an unsatisfactory chapter in the conceptual framework is also not satisfying. No. But probably the best way forward is to do nothing. Wei Guo?
2 points. The first one about the capital maintenance, I fully support Steve's views. And the second about page 16, the last bullet point, about whether we should discuss more about entry and exit, entity specific and non entity specific. We once discussed, but finally we dropped. I think the reason was, we can discuss, but come out to how to select measurement basis, whether it is useful enough for us to maintain. I personally feel, current ED has done a very good job. We touch a little bit about entity and non-entity already. But as to entry and exit, if we want to describe, as I said, how much we can use those terms to discuss about selection of measurement basis, I feel doubt. And I once I remember the Japanese the board and once give us a very comprehensive papers, and they called the three dimension or four dimension type of considerations, and it is very thoughtful, but we have to make conceptual framework statement as concise as possible and as useful as possible to discuss anything. And I personally feel, it is not so obvious. We have to discuss all these terms separately.
Just coming back to capital maintenance issue, I'm not in the camp who says we should delete it, but rather we should discuss it thoroughly. However, I do understand that it is quite challenging for us to discuss it thoroughly. So then the point is, how do you deal with it, the current wording? So that is the issue which I raised out at an outset. So what is the finalization of our conceptual framework for now? So if we say this is the current best conceptual framework we can provide, then the wording of capital maintenance, current wording of capital maintenance seems to be a little bit odd. So therefore, if that is the case, we have to clearly say we are going to discuss it in the future, or we should take a time to discuss whether or not we should change the wording of capital maintenance, or how would interact with other concepts.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Thank you. Thank you, Rachel. So presentation and disclosure is discussed in agenda paper 10J and slide 18. So roughly about half of the respondents to the exposure draft commented on presentation and disclosure. And generally, many people agreed with our proposals, and many people generally welcomed the board's work on presentation and disclosure, both in the conceptual framework and disclosure initiative. However, some respondents disagreed with particular aspects of the proposals or made particular suggestions how proposals might be improved. And one particular area which attracted most comments and suggestions is the scope and content of financial statements, and in particular, the distinction between primary financial statements and notes, and scope of financial statements as a whole, as opposed to other information which can be included in annual reports. There were some respondents who asked the board to identify in the conceptual framework what are the primary financial statements and what are the notes, and therefore a few respondents who expressed concerns about removal of the explicit reference to the cash flow statement and also to the statement of changes in equity, and that they wondered whether that meant those statements were not primary, and they had concerns about that implication. There were also some respondents who felt that the boundary between financial statements as a whole and other information is not very clear, and some felt that the guidance proposed in the conceptual framework, in the exposure draft, could result in financial statements being too broad. So that was another common thing. And finally, there was a number of respondents who commented on the interaction between conceptual framework and disclosure initiative, and that they stated that the interaction between those projects is not very clear, it needs to be clarified.
There you go.
What Yuri summarized exactly my views expressed when we add these aspects. And from beginning, when we plan the project, I clearly suggest we should not, you know, cover too much with the condition we want to have a short-term project, even though maybe 6-7 years, still short-term enough. And it is so obvious, you know, we cover something which we actually will not be able to provide too many guidance for our future standard. And this is the areas I feel it is so weak, and also relate to the another chapter. I'm not sure why the Rachel you omit that is the hard part of the reporting entity chapter, and we have something about the structure of financial statement, and I also feel, you know, it is so meaningful, meaningless, you know, in that part. And this is related to the strategy we may decide in the coming months, you know, whether we want to still keep this or not. I personally feel it is not so useful if we maintain current quality.
In which case, can we move on to information about financial performance?
Yes, information about financial performance is discussed in agenda paper 10K. I think generally it's fair to say that the feedback on the exposure draft confirmed that there are very mixed views about providing information about financial performance. And what I found quite interesting in looking in the comments that not that only there are very diverse views, but also those diverse views informed stakeholders' reactions to the exposure draft quite differently. And what I mean is that there were some people who would have exactly the same view, but they would express different views on our proposals. And there are some people who hold opposite views, but they express the same view on our proposals. So for example, there are some people who think that all OCI items should be recycled. And some of those respondents agreed with the rebuttable presumption in the exposure draft. But then there are some people who think that all OCI items should be recycled, and they disagreed with the proposals in the exposure draft because they felt that the rebuttable presumption does not go far enough. And equally, you could have a situation, for example, where there are some respondents who think that OCI should be brought, and they disagree with our proposals on that basis. But then there are also some respondents who do not agree with the binary split between P&L and OCI, and they generally advocate a single statement of performance. So this is a very different view, and they still disagree with our proposal. So that was a very interesting interaction. I think also at a very high level, it is fair to say that there was a significant degree of disagreement with some or all aspects of our proposals. And many respondents felt that the proposed guidance is not conceptual or is not sufficient in assisting the board in future standard setting. There were some respondents who stated that they would support the proposals as an interim step, and the board should come back and revisit the conceptual framework in the future when more work on reporting financial performance is done. But then on the other hand, some respondents cautioned the board against how much guidance we include in the conceptual framework at this point in time, such that we do not prejudge the results of any further work. Now, if we look at the feedback on particular aspects of the proposals, I think that this proposed description of profit or loss was one aspect of the proposals which agreed most support. But then again, the views behind that support are quite different. So, for example, some respondents agree with the proposals because they think P&L is primary and OCI is not even performance. On the other hand, some people agree with the description because they think of P&L being primary as the most inclusive source of information about performance, and OCI being only used in some exceptional cases. There were also a number of people who asked for more guidance about profit or loss, or who asked the board to define profit or loss. But again, what exactly they wanted was quite different. So for example, some wanted the board to clearer articulate the purpose of profit or loss. Some others wanted the board to define subtotal or total for profit or loss. And some others wanted the board to make the distinction between income and expenses included in OCI and profit or loss clearer. So very different flavors. There was a significant amount of disagreement with proposals on OCI, and that disagreement falls into two main categories. Some people just disagree with the proposals because they think OCI should be used for something else. Either it should be broader or it should be narrower. And then there is other category who just think that the proposals are not sufficient, and they disagree on that basis. In terms of the proposals on recycling, about half of the respondents thought that all OCI items should be recycled, and then half of them agreed with the proposals, and about half of them disagreed because it's not enough. There were some people who thought that some but not OCI items should be recycled, and there were a few who thought that OCI should never be recycled. And there were also a few respondents who stated that they sort of do not support the notion of a rebuttable presumption in the conceptual framework, and it needs to be sort of more neutral and principle-based. So I think that's the main theme on profit or loss and OCI.
Clear direction.
Recently, I circulated an article to the board, which some of you might be interested in. It appeared in the January-February 16 issue of the Financial Analyst Journal. It's called Misrepresentation of Earnings. And I think it's very instructive because it dovetails with a lot of the subjects that Ilya just discussed. And I think one of the challenges here that it's highlighted in this article, the reason I raise it, is because we are trying to provide, obviously, useful information. And what a survey of, I think it was something like 400 CFOs in this article, indicates that high-quality earnings are typically associated with something's streams that are sustainable and predictable. And so if the presentation can, in fact, highlight those elements of income and expense that are sustainable and predictable from those that are less so, not exclude them, but just less so, okay, then I think we're doing a good job in terms of communicating what most people believe are high-quality earnings, which are earnings that are converted to cash pretty consistently and readily over time. Where people have problems is where you're making long-term estimates, and it doesn't necessarily mean fair values. It can be a loss contingency, right? A liability associated with a lawsuit. It could be, you know, decommissioning costs. It could be an accrual for anything, okay, where they have problems. Those types of long-term estimates tend to have a lower quality of earnings associated with them. And this was one of the reasons why I highlighted in my alternative view, it's important for people to understand the differences between cash and non-cash changes in assets and liabilities, because the things that are cash changes, they associate with high quality earnings. Things that are non-cash, they tend to be less associated. So I think if in a structured electronic environment, we can create a P&L, Statement of Comprehensive Income, that's going to disaggregate components of income and expense along these lines that are converted to cash more readily, those that which are not converted to cash as readily, then I think we'll be doing a much better job ultimately in communicating what we broadly call performance. Is that you know, the definition of how we use OCI? I don't know. It's a possibility. Another topic that came up, that came through here loud and clear, in terms of quality of earnings, where CFOs feel an important point to communicate, is what's controllable, what they have control over versus which is completely uncontrollable. And they want to be held accountable for things that are controllable, and they don't want to be held accountable so much for the things that are not controllable. Well, obviously,
the CFO is fired.
Right. And so, you know, that's the perfect world, but the reality is it comes with the territory, right? You're charged with that, and you're going to have to deal with it. But I think making those types of elements of income and expense more clear, more transparent, I think might help bridge the gap between those people who are, you know, solidly against fair value and long-term estimates making their way into financial statements, and hence, you know, emphasize the need for prudence, and those people who feel, give me all the information, all the things that are relevant, I'll make my own decision as to what reliability, what, you know, predictability, what sustainability I assign to them. I think we need to bridge that two sets of views, and I think presentation is a way to do it. Disaggregation is a way to do it. Trying to come up with defined subtotals, operating income, core earnings, that is not the way to go. That is definitely not the way to go, because every person around this room will have a different definition of what core earnings are or what operating earnings are.
I think what you were just describing was a system with subtotals.
No.
One piece of income which is close to cash, and another piece of income which
is... Well, that's a subtotal, not numerous subtotals. So distinguishing, I think, components of income between those two categories isn't creating a definition, in my view, for operating or core earnings. Okay, it's just simply giving you a different feel as to what essentially is contributing to that change in net assets.
We used to do that breakup between cash and non-cash in the source and application of funds statement.
Yeah, that's
not,
right.
Not through the profit and loss. I think it'll be very difficult to do through the profit.
Gary?
Rachel, in the discussion in your, I guess it's in paragraph 7, we said, and of which I agree, that the P&L is the primary source of information about your performance, of course not the only source. And at the same time, in paragraph 6, we propose not to define P&L in total. And I appreciate elements and stuff that we do define. And I think in part we chose not to define it because of the difficulty in defining it. You know, we might know the total P&L and OCI, but how to rationally articulate the split, you know, on a sustainable basis, we didn't get there. So my, with that as a setup, my question is, a lot of people say we should define P&L. Did anyone actually offer a usable suggestion or two? And by the way, I do agree with Pat, we don't try to define core earnings or anything like that, I think.
Yeah, there were some suggestions, not necessarily very specific, but at least directional suggestions. Like, for example, you know, profit or loss should sort of be reflecting business model of the entity. A total for profit or loss is income less expenses or something like that. OCI should be used for the measurements of long-term items, or OCI should be used for all the measurements. So there was a number of suggestions. There was also a suggestion similar to what Pat described, where P&L is sort of reserved for persistent items with high predictive value, and other items are reported in OCI. But there was certainly no common theme.
Nothing. Okay, so that's nothing new in what you would say.
Yeah.
That's also just sort of, you know, ordinary, you know, input, you know, we've been getting lot of over time, but it doesn't add anything, doesn't move the ball forward, I don't think.
One thing that struck me, I think it was this paper, but the overall feedback is that a lot of the world thinks we have a project on performance reporting. If you look at our agenda, the only place we really have it is here in the conceptual framework, and I think the level of specificity that people are looking for in performance reporting is more a standards level specificity, although we do need some, you know, some anchoring concepts from the conceptual framework. But I think one of the things to think about in terms of strategy coming back is pulling out the comments that we think are people asking for something that may be more a standards level project. Maybe we can or maybe we can't do it. And then thinking about what that implies we need to do first in the, you know, in the conceptual framework project. I don't think we should try and answer the standards level questions and comments here, but I think it's important input for our agenda consultation feedback, and I think I'm drawing on some of the responses there. We have the primary financial statement project, which is really the spin-off of the disclosure initiative, and while it's expected to be focused on, let's say, line item requirements, I'm not sure that it will answer the things that people, I think, maybe because it's the same combination of letters as, you know, the FSB project, they think it's reviving everything from that, and I think it's a more limited project. So I think we have to get our project scopes set, and I think we have to communicate those to the world, and that will help us decide what we do in the conceptual framework versus potential standards level projects. So that's, I think, something to think about in terms of the strategy in this area.
I think for the strategy we should have, I think the key is, for me, you know, whether we should keep OCI term or not is a key. And if we want to keep it, I personally feel, you know, the current ED is okay, but of course we need further refinement. Like, you know, whether we want to have a rebuttable concept of presumption or not. And I personally feel we pay too much attention to OCI. And this is why when we develop the ED, I once described my view, that is, in the chapter element, you know, we decide not to use the term gain and loss. And I agree with, then I say, you know, we should say, you know, income expenses can be divided in different ways. And gain, revenue and expense and loss is one way, and OCI not is another way. And as long as we all agree, subtotal is useful. And so I think that the key decision we should have is whether we should still use the term. And we once struggled And I remember Hans would say that if we want to eliminate terms, people may cry, you know, but this is the area we have to decide. As to the what Pat described, I personally broadly agree with what you said, but one thing I'm not so clear. You know, you described something analyst wants. I already see three dimensions. Firstly, persistent or not. Second, cash or not cash. And thirdly, controllable or not controllable. And my question to you is, in your mind, that multi-dimensional or, you know, the two categories type?
I think you can present it in a number of different ways. The CFA Institute had a recommendation which was multidimensional. They had three columns. They said current period transactions, which were either cash-like or short-term estimates. They had long-term estimates, okay, which were non-cash, and they had fair value measurements. You could do that in a pancake sort of way, in not having multiple columns, and have the same types of designations and put the explanation in the notes. So there's a lot of different ways you could lay it out. I think the key thing is whether or not you actually go down the path of disaggregation. That's the key principle, I think, that we have to decide we want to embrace.
Yeah, I think from a long-term perspective, I agree with this kind of notion. But of course, it will be debatable, you know, if we want to decide to do so.
Yeah.
But from a long-term point of view, I will agree with better than binary type of, you know, classification. This is the troubles we now have.
Right.
Talk.
Yes.
We have to go back to the agenda consultation 2011. The strongest message we received at that time was we should prevent abuse of OCI because we don't have clear concept. Without having clear concept, to abuse OCI undermines the quality of the financial statement. That is the clear message we were given from the agenda consultation. And therefore, what the constituents are expecting us to do is to provide robust principle about the OCI or robust principle about the performance. However, as we discussed, it is quite difficult. So some kind of compromise is rebuttable presumption. However, still, rebuttable presumption does not really provide, you know, robust principle. What is the relevant is all about. And then I respect what the Pat said. To some extent, we could put it in this way. So that's understandable. But on the other hand, there are some strong arguments which says the total cash flow of the transaction should meet the cumulative amount of profit or loss so that, you know, everything should be clear. All the cumulative amount of profit or loss should meet the cash flow in the end. So then, actually, this is really a conflicting concept. And then what we have to consider is what is the time frame of the performance. So if you think the performance is the total performance of the entity from the beginning to the liquidation, then the total cash flow and the total cumulative amount of profit or loss should meet. Such kind of concept has some meaning. But we have to measure the performance, not just entire life of an entity, but we have to measure the performance based on the some period we discuss. And it could be 1 year period, or it could be 3 months, or it could be 5 years or 10 years. So then the performance relates to the length of the period. So we have to, you know, consider such kind of interaction between period and cash flow. So that is what we need to discuss. And then the OCI could be a tool to make these difference of period understandable. So I think we need to provide some clear concept, otherwise constituents wouldn't be satisfied.
Thank you.
Stephen?
I think much of this discussion is now standards level, and I agree with Mary that the key thing for us is to progress on reporting performance or whatever we call that particular project. I agree with Pat that disaggregation is key, and that aspect of your alternative view I agree with, but I'm very nervous about jumping into cash flow based disaggregation, because then I start thinking about share-based payments and, well, what happens there, and controllable versus non-controllable. Very nervous about using that as a basis. And I think all of these issues need a wider discussion in a standards level project, because I'm not sure that they are concepts. It's about how we best present rather than a fundamental concept to underpin financial reporting. Maybe transparency, disaggregation, effectiveness of presentation is sort of the overriding principle and the concepts, but this discussion about cash and non-cash, that to my mind is standards level.
Would you also then have the OCI question at a standards level?
Yes.
Okay, I agree with that.
Which is perfectly possible with the work that we have done. Because I still think the principles we have developed are pretty good. Basically says you need a high hurdle for the use of OCI, which is that it should enhance the value of the P&L. I agree with all who say we need to do more work on disaggregation, and well, it will be very difficult, but I think we can make progress in that. I don't think that will solve the OCI question, because even if you find a good way to disaggregate fair value remeasurements, ultimately what counts is the bottom line, profit or loss, much more than if we, for example, would make a subtotal of operating income or persistent earnings, whatever that may be. I'm very, very suspicious of that kind of reasoning. But ultimately, what counts is the bottom line. And if we find a neat disaggregation for fair value remeasurements, but it will still influence the bottom line, people will be just as unhappy with it as they are now. I don't think it will solve the problem. True. And about this recycling, perhaps we can also do a little bit more thinking about that. I think our major worry about recycling is that it often distorts performance.
Yes.
When you recycle an equity investment that was done in year one and that is cashed in on year 30, and you take the whole profit of 30 years into that year 30, yeah, completely distorts the performance. It should never be recycled. It should be taken as you go. The best way to achieve this fact that profit or loss are ultimately the same as the cash flows is to not bother with the OCI too much.
And you say ultimately what counts is the bottom line, but why is that? Is that a market convention? Is that something that we've created through the work that we've done? Why should it be so that ultimately what counts is the bottom line?
Well, I have to be a little bit more precise. What counts most is bottom line. Because we can struggle defining what profit or loss is, but the average man in the street knows exactly what profit is.
But in practice, I think what counts most is not necessarily the bottom line as we define it, profit and loss. There's the non-GAAP earnings, there's operating profit, there's a whole load of metrics that may count most in different circumstances. And basing our work on this assumption that net income as we currently define it is the holy grail and we've just got to find a way of refining it, I think is boxing ourselves in far too much in any project we do on a wider discussion of performance.
But I don't think we will be able to beat market convention that concentrates on the bottom line. And quite frankly, as an investor, that's what I would be most interested in, knowing that it can fluctuate greatly from year to year.
One follow-up observation. A number of respondents in your paper you mentioned said there was no discussion about the statement of cash flows. And this, the observation I made in my alternative view was essentially designed to capture that issue. Because irrespective of how you decide to display performance, if every period a investor who's reading the financial statements knows the change in loans was 95% a function of collection of cash and 5% a change in management's estimate, okay, you effectively have what you need, okay? You don't need a cash flow statement, frankly, at that point in time. So for all those banks who want to get rid of the cash flow statement, I have a solution for them, okay? And in a couple of months, I'm ready to consult and charge them no less than, you know, fair value for my services to design that information. So at the end of the day, though, if somebody's looking at a bank's financial statements, they want to know how much they collected in cash, okay? How much of those loans did you collect? So to say the cash flow statement is irrelevant, okay, for a bank, I always find quite amusing, or an insurance company, because if they don't, they got to go to another bank, the one that Mario Draghi oversees. And at the end of the day, that's not a good situation. So cash is king. I don't care what business you're in, whether you're in banks or you're selling iPods.
But you made a different statement earlier with the source and application of funds thing.
No, you did, not me.
I did, but that was what you said in your paper, according to the papers here.
What paragraph are you referring to?
I can't go back to it now, but it was quoting your alternative.
I just think it's important to disaggregate those changes.
Yeah, that's right. But it's if important. You do that, you don't need a cash flow statement.
That's right. Effectively.
Okay, good.
Yeah. But more importantly, it is information that is critical for every business, including businesses that lend money and collect money on a daily basis.
Martin.
But I agree with Steve. I think if we don't really thinking a little bit out of the box here with this performance, I think we will not solve it, because clearly if we would say, okay, that the net income or bottom line will stay, then I agree it will be difficult really to come up with OCI, what is not OCI, but maybe we come with better information and really make it more transparent, make a type of portion which is maybe then operating, maybe which is financial, something new. And that maybe, I think also what we currently seeing is when this non-GAAP financial measures are used, because I think not everybody is happy with the bottom line and wants to have more. And therefore, I think we have to think out of the box. But what I want to say is I think doing that, we should not finalize this area in the conceptual framework, because that will limit us in this broader thinking about the performance measurement project, performance project. And therefore, I think we should defer this chapter and then working on the performance project and then maybe come back, because otherwise I think it will limit us in this project.
Martin, I think I agree largely with you, and because I do feel we need to do more work to give investors better tools and also to create some more discipline around non-GAAP or just make it a little bit less necessary. All I'm trying to say is that the bottom line will remain very important whatever we do, and the sensitivity of including part of remeasurements in profit or loss or outside profit or loss, that will be made. We will not, I don't think we will be able to solve that completely with doing work on performance reporting and better disaggregation. Greg Guo?
I want to ask Steve two questions. It's not challenging. And relate to our future policy or strategy. In the past, many people challenge us, say, you know, OCI, there's no conceptual basis. And in some of our standards, when we add OCI, we also claim. So I didn't agree. And we still agree with this statement, OCI, there's no conceptual basis.
that.
Well, we use it for a variety of things, and in each case we thought we had a good reason for doing so, and there are some common themes, the remeasurement, but it's difficult to find a single solid conceptual basis for the way we use OCR at the moment.
Yeah, my second question is, if we follow what you just suggested, we not touch this issue at all, and we have a standard level project on performance, may end up with subtotals, I fully agree with. And whether under such conditions people challenge us, wait a minute, all those subtotals, particularly the next one, or the bottom next one, there is no conceptual basis. How will you respond to people?
Well, I would hope that if we were able to present performance in a more meaningful way, that there would be a conceptual basis. There would be a more common link between the way in which we classify and the sections that we might have or the subtotals that we might use.
The reason why people challenge us in the past is we not use OCI persistently, and we cannot give a very clear justification. Therefore, people say there is no conceptual basis, which I not agree with. But if we go the ways you just described, and people come back again and say, wait a minute, you know, you decided to have such subtotals. There's nothing mentioned in the conceptual framework basis. Therefore, people challenge us again.
But isn't that
how
why
can we respond to?
Well, yeah, so we don't have anything in the conceptual framework about gross profit, and yet we think having gross profit is quite a useful presentation. So why do we have to have something in the concept statement that justifies every subtotal in financial statements? Is it a standards level question about presentation of interest income or whatever it is?
I thought that was why Steve suggested some of the ideas Pat was suggesting were more standards level questions.
Yeah,
I'm on your side.
Tuck, and let's talk finally on this subject and then we move on.
Just quickly, back to the Hans' comment, the recycle would distort the performance. I totally agree with. So if you sell the equity and then you recognize all the income on that period, that really distorts the performance for that period. But if you look at the period in the much longer basis, it could provide some useful information which totally connected with the cash flows. And actually, Pat said that cash is the king. So then the but however, the some people are struggling with the disconnection with the performance and the total cash flows. So then the question is, what's the bottom line is all about? I totally agree that people are looking for what is the bottom line. And we have to provide the answer. This is the bottom line you can use. So that is the most difficult area. However, we could disaggregate as maybe in the presentation or some other standard basis, something like the outright profit, which does not contain any recycle. And then we can provide some recycled profit, and then total profit or something like that. And then, although, you know, we cannot say this is the real bottom line, however, we can clearly segregate it. Actually, we are trying to do that in the IS1. But I don't think it's enough. So if we could provide very good articulation, maybe it can be done in the standard basis, not really in the conceptual basis. But we have to provide an answer. And then constituents waiting for us, what is the time frame for them to get the answer from ISD? Would it be done in the performance reporting project or in the conceptual framework? So what is the answer? When we can get the clear answer, that is the, you know, needs for constituents.
I suggest that Stephen, we move on, if you don't mind.
activities and long-term investments?
Business activities and long-term investment are discussed in agenda paper 10L. Almost all respondents who commented on business activities agreed that the way an entity conducts its business has a role to play in financial reporting. However, there were different views as to how big that role can be. About half of the respondents who commented on business activities agreed that business activities have a role to play in some but not all aspects of financial reporting, and broadly agreed with the level of the discussion in the exposure draft. Other respondents asked the board to give more prominence to business activities and the conceptual framework, and they believed that it had a role to play in all aspects of financial reporting. There were a few respondents who disagreed with any sort of mention of business activities in the conceptual framework, and that was primarily they either believed that using business activities might impair comparability of financial statements, or because they felt that the notion of business activities or business model needed more research. There was also an interesting common theme regarding the use of terminology. There were some respondents who did not seem to make any distinction between the notions of business activities and business model, and some used those terms interchangeably. There were some respondents who expressed a preference for a particular term. Some preferred the term business model, and they tended to want more prominence for the business model in the conceptual framework. And some respondents preferred the term business activities, and they tended to be quite happy with the level of the discussion in the exposure draft. There were also a few respondents who asked the board to clarify whether business activities and business model are different things or the same thing, and in particular, whether business activities in the exposure draft and business model in FRS 9 are the same notions or different. Moving on to long-term investment, many respondents who commented on long-term investment broadly agreed with the board's approach in the exposure draft, and they agreed that the proposed guidance is sufficient for the board to make standard setting decisions for long-term investments, and also sufficient to meet information needs for all users, including long-term investors. And in particular, almost all standard setters, regulators, accounting firms, and accounting bodies who commented on the proposals were sort of happy with the board's approach. They stated that as long as the objective of financial reporting is met, all user information needs will be met. They agreed that it's not appropriate to include a discussion about a particular business model in the conceptual framework, and some even challenged whether long-term investment is a business model, and they stated that objectives of long-term investment can be quite different and it's not sort of a business model per se. And there were some respondents who disagreed with the board's approach and who thought that the proposals do not give the board enough tools to make appropriate decisions for long-term investment business model, and do not result in meeting the information needs of long-term investors. So I think with that I stop and see if there are questions.
No comments.
Which final paper from Elena.
So we are now moving on to the final paper, agenda paper 10, and on the effects of the revision of the conceptual framework and comments on a separate exposure draft, which is updating reference to the framework. In the basis for conclusions on the main exposure draft, we included an analysis of inconsistencies between the existing standards and the proposed conceptual framework. It was requested by respondents to the discussion paper who wanted to see what would be the implications of the revising the conceptual framework. And while some respondents agreed with this analysis of inconsistencies, some suggested some other inconsistencies, and we will analyze them for future papers. And there was a group of respondents who asked for more comprehensive analysis. And as we've touched on before, there were different views on how it should be done, with some thinking that it should be field testing the proposals. And this view was mostly expressed when respondents were talking about definitions. and there was another group who wanted a standard by standard analysis of inconsistencies, and they also wanted the board to develop some sort of strategy with dealing with those inconsistencies. Mostly the respondents agreed with the proposal in the, of the board that there will be no automatic revision of the standards, but there was a small minority of respondents, most of them were from Latin America or from Asia Oceania, who wanted the board to address all inconsistencies, with some of them wanting the board to do it before the conceptual framework is published. Now, moving on to the separate exposure draft, we propose to replace references to the framework with a reference to the conceptual framework to make sure that there is only one version of the framework in existence. And we got quite a lot of support for that, but again, there were some who were concerned about unintended consequences of those changes, and again, they wanted us to have to undertake some sort of an effects analysis. And here again, there were different groups of people. Some wanted us to look at all the proposed changes and what would be the effects of those, and some focused on impact on preparers who select and develop accounting policies in accordance with IS1 and IS8. So with that, are there any questions or comments?
Mary?
A minor one, and it goes back to the comment before about I think we need an analysis of how we think the interaction of IS1 and IS8 works, and I think in terms of our plan of operation, we should have that before you ask us to make a decision about what, if any, further effects analysis or assessment needs to be done of the implication of changing the footnotes. Because if we're able to articulate how we think and how often we expect a preparer to have to look to the framework, I think that would inform our assessment of the feedback we got about the potential for further work in connection with the separate ED.
Okay. Well, just on 1 minute over time. So you did well. Thank you very much. We continue Porter Task 1.